patients. There will be a slight change on the program that we will take the presentation by the Center for Constitutional Rights first, and then we'll go back and start with freedom of religion. Actually, we should be starting with the freedom of religion, because we want to get everybody to be ethically and morally correct. But it's a pity that we'll start with the lawyers. Who is leading us from the center for? You are dangerously close to me. I wish there was someone from the religion close to me.
Thank you very much. And again, thank you very much for also changing the program to accordingly accommodate us. So as has already been mentioned, we are from the Center for Constitutional Rights. My name is Pepela Pidube, and I am the director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. And I'm accompanied by my colleague and attorney and our legal officer, Ms. Christina Boyka, who's going to make the presentation on our behalf. And thereafter, we'll both be available to answer questions from the committee. And we'd just like to state at the outset that we do welcome this bill insofar as it attempts to place South Africa in the 20th century, insofar as cybersecurity and cybercrimes are concerned. But that said, we do have a few concerns regarding the bill, and my colleague is going to elaborate on that. And we'd just like to point out that we recognize the highly technical nature of the bill. But that said, in line with our particular mandate, our job today is to only focus on the constitutional aspects of the bill. That said, we are the Center for Constitutional Rights. We're based here in Cape Town, and our work is to primarily monitor developments that affect the Constitution, and making submissions to Parliament is one of the ways in which we do that. And without further ado, I'm going to hand over to my colleague, Ms. Christine Boyta. Good morning, everyone. We have absolutely no relation to CASAC. We are independent of CASAC. Good morning, everyone, and morning to all honourable members present here today and representatives from the Department of Justice. It's a privilege to share our views on the bill today, and we did submit a written submission as well. So what I'm going to do today, I'm just going to make sure, can everyone hear me? I'm close enough to my microphone. Okay. So what I'm going to do today is only to highlight certain concerns. For a more detailed version, please see our written submissions as well. So, turning to a bill in the discussion, as our director said, we do feel there are definitely positive amendments made to a bill since the initial 2015 draft. And we just want to welcome the removal specifically of the computer-related espionage offence. Okay. As well as the infringement of copyright offence and a few more as well. Are we good here? The Centre, however, is concerned that despite certain provisions which still unduly impact on the right to freedom of expression. Sorry, is that correct? Oh, it doesn't like, okay, it is off. Oh.
No. If the switching on, that makes it hard.
When they are both on.
Okay, like this. Okay, so I don't know how many could actually hear me. So again, I just want to say we concern that certain provisions in the bill might unduly impact on the constitutional right to freedom of expression, privacy, and access to court. As Ms. Dubey said, we're not cyber law experts, and we only limited our comments to certain specific set of concerns. For ease of reference, we have two specific sets of concerns. Firstly, the proposed chapter on malicious communications, I think that's chapter 3, and its impact on the right to freedom of expression. Then secondly, a failure of a bill to address the shortcomings in RICA, that is now a regulation of interception of communication and provision of communications related act, and indirectly the impact on the right to privacy as well as access to courts. Now, before turning to specific concerns, I just wish to highlight a specific constitutional right in this instance and just expand shortly on the meaning. So, firstly, a right to freedom of expression in Section 16 of the Constitution. Now, this includes the freedom to receive and impart information or ideas. So, it is crucial that measures proposed in the bill do not stifle the free flow of information. And what I want to point out here, it's very important, especially considering the chapter on malicious communication, to consider exactly what prohibited forms, what forms of expression in the Constitution is specifically prohibited. This, for instance, relates to propaganda for war, incitement to imminent violence, as well as advocacy of hatred based on certain specific grounds, and that constitutes incitement to cause harm. Importantly here is that unless your expression, which you are prohibiting, falls into one of these specific categories, it will infringe on right to freedom of expression. And one will need to go and consider, one will need to measure if it's a reasonable and justifiable limitation in terms of the Constitution. So, as previously said, we also concerned about the right to privacy as well as access to court. This specifically relates to our second set of concerns in relation to the provision of interception of communication. So, just briefly, Section 14 of the Constitution concerns the right to privacy, and this includes the right not to have one's privacy of one's communication infringed. I just want to point out here that the Constitutional Court has emphasized the closer the inner sanctum of one's home is infringed, the higher the justification will need to be. Okay, so if we turn to Section 34 of the Constitution, this guarantees everyone the right to access to courts. So this means basically everyone has the right to have a dispute resolved before a court of law in terms of a public hearing. In our written submission, we also highlighted some international law which reinforces South Africa's commitment to these specific rights, and certain international principles, if I can call it, which we believe should, which we believe could be used as guidance as well. So just to, sorry, one back. So this specifically relates to, so this specifically relates to the Human Rights Commission principles, set of principles that they launched, known as the International Principles on Application of Human Rights to Communication Surveillance. It's also known as the Necessary and Proportionate Principles. And it's not binding on South Africa, but these principles highlight how human rights are supposed to be protected in terms of communication surveillance. There's, for instance, an emphasis on the right to transparency and proportionality. Sorry, I just want to go one step back again. I saw I missed one step. So if these rights of privacy, so constitutional rights, so if you look specifically on the whiteboard now, so if those specific rights to privacy and your right to freedom of expression and access to courts are to be limited, like I said, it needs to be a reasonable and justifiable limitation. And there's a general limitation test in terms of the Constitution one will consider. And one will consider various factors, one will balance these factors out. Now, I just want to point out regarding the bill, there are the following factors we would like to emphasize. Firstly, the nature and extent of the limitation. And this is where one will consider if there's a use of overboard terminology or if it's vague. Secondly, the relation between the limitation and its purpose. And then lastly, I want to highlight less restrictive means to achieve a purpose. So this is where we begin to ask, is there really a need for additional criminal measures? Do we not already have legislative measures which could address these concerns? Lastly, overall, in terms of the rule of law, legislation is supposed to be clear and written in such a manner that your ordinary man or woman knows exactly what conduct is prohibited. Okay, so let me just get to it. So our specific analysis of the key clauses. So like I said, our first set of concerns relates to malicious communication. And specifically, we considered clause 16 and 17. So clause 16 relates to a data message which incites damage to property or violence, and 17 relates to a data message which is harmful. Now, again, I want to reiterate, the Constitution, specifically Section 16.2, narrowly prohibits certain forms of expression. So unless it falls into these categories, it will infringe the right to freedom of expression. Now, if I could just simplify it, what I've done is I want to highlight certain general concerns we have with the prohibition of malicious communication, as well as specific concerns where we'll go into detail regarding Clause 16 and 17. Okay. So to measure if it's a reasonable and justifiable limitation on the right to freedom of expression, it is crucial that key elements of offence need to be defined. So we find no definition, for instance, to make available, to broadcast, or to distribute. There's also no cross-reference to terminology in other legislation, for instance, the Forms and Publication Amendment Act, or other proposed legislation such as even the controversial prevention and combating of hate crimes and hate speech bill. So can I just give an example, for instance? I noted hate crimes bill was also drafted by the Department of Justice and Correctional Services. And I just want to point out, for instance, the definition of a data message in these two bills differ. So it already creates confusion. So now if we turn to specific concerns, if we look at clause 16 of the bill, this relates to data message which incites damage to property or violence. Now the Constitution only speaks of incitement to imminent violence. It doesn't say incitement to violence. Now the concept imminent violence has a specific degree of violence attached to it, has a specific connotation as well. And it appears from our research, it specifically has its roots in the U.S. Supreme Court matter of Brandenburg versus Ohio, and it's directed at inciting or producing imminent lawless action and is likely to produce or incite such harm. So if we turn back to a specific clause, it's uncertainty regarding the degree of violence we're talking about, and if you consider there's no definition for crucial elements such as to broadcast or to distribute, there's also no requirement that actual harm has to manifest. So this is not a narrow limitation on the right to freedom of expression. Also, if we consider if it's a reasonable limitation, we have to ask ourselves, are these additional measures, criminal measures, necessary? And what do we already have? What legislative measures do we already have? In this instance, we already have existing legislation dealing with public violence. For instance, the Prevention of Public Violence and Intimidation Act, or the Regulation of Gatherings Act as well. There are also similar remedies, for instance, available, specifically if one look at the damage to property, and there is even the common law crime of malicious damage to property. So important here with the malicious damage to property is that actual destruction is a requirement, from what I could see from my research. So clause 16 isn't a reasonable limitation. It's overbroad, and existing remedies do already exist in this instance. If we now turn to a data message which is harmful, that is clause 17, I just want to point out in general, on reading this prohibition, it wasn't quite clear what the drafters intended to do and how this would interact, for instance, with the Harassment Act, and if the intention was to broaden the scope of the Harassment Act, because it echoes certain measures of Act as well. And again, it's unclear why there's this need for additional criminal measures. If we look at the Harassment Act, for instance, the definition of harassment is already very widely defined. It does cover cyber harassment. It could even cover cyber stalking, even though it's not specifically defined, and it covers cyberbullying. So, and a failure, for instance, to adhere to a condition in a protection order in terms of the Harassment Act is a criminal offence already punishable by 5 years imprisonment. So, as I said, what we see is additional criminal measures, and these additional measures aren't preventative in nature. I think that's an also important point to highlight here as well. So, if we look at Clause 17, what it essentially does is it creates these various instances to when a data message would be considered harmful. Like I said earlier, we're not sure how it will interact with, for instance, the Harassment Act as well as other legislation. And I want to give you a specific example. The term harmful is not defined in the Harassment Act. The Harassment Act only talks about harm. Harm is defined as any mental, psychological, physical, economic harm, and it defines various acts or conduct which would constitute as harassment. However, the term harmful, we do find it in the promotion of equality and prevention of unfair discrimination act. That's now your Equality Act, and this is specifically in relation to hate speech. But interesting, the Equality Act doesn't define harmful, so that's always been a bit of a problem. So now what you actually have, you have a statutory definition of what harmful expression would be. So this interaction, we believe, this overlap causes confusion, and it's unclear when what will apply. Now, if I could break it down, specifically Clause 17 and our specific concerns, and we look at, if you want to follow Clause 17 to subsection B to D. So, this is a specific instances to when a data message would be harmful. What we see here specifically is reference to undefined terminology. I want to give you an example. It's, for instance, to threaten a group of persons, identified persons forming part of a group or inherently false in nature. And the question, for instance, would be, what conduct would be considered to threaten a person with violence to threaten with violence any identified person forming part of a group? My question is, how would a person be identified as part of a group? Are there certain common characteristics we are looking at, and which common characteristics then? And is this actually an indirect manner to protect those characteristics? So again, it's overbroad, and it's not a narrowly tailored. It's not, the limitation is not narrow. And then, if we look at Clause 17 to Subsection C, So this relates to a data message which intimidates, encourages, harasses a person to harm himself or herself or any other person. As previously noted, we already have the Harassment Act, which covers this, for instance. And what I want to also point out here, our understanding is it's not clear how these two will interact. And I find there's a conflict between the Harassment Act providing how you'd go about for applying for a protection order, which is very similar, which covers very similar circumstances as where you apply for a protection order in terms of the bill. Just to give you an example, for instance, the Harassment Act says a protection order may be brought on behalf of a complainant by another person who has a material interest in the well-being of the complainant, but you do not find in a bill. Secondly, the Harassment Act also refers to an interim protection order on prima facie evidence before a protection order will be granted. Now, in terms of a bill, the protection order is pending criminal proceedings for the offence. So the overlap in similar circumstances does not make sense, and again, it will create confusion. Then lastly, and as regarding malicious communication, I just want to turn your attention to Clause 17(2)(d). Now, this relates to a message which is will be considered harmful if it's inherently false in nature and it's aimed at causing mental, psychological, physical, or economical harm to a specific person, for instance. I just want to break it in two. First, the first part inherently false in nature. There's no objective criteria. We don't know how it will be considered inherently false in nature. Secondly, if you look at this aim at causing mental various forms of harm, that's exactly what harm is described as in the Harassment Act. So what we see here is it's taking a little bit from the Harassment Act and it's adding to it to make a whole new definition of what would be considered harmful data messages. Again, we have civil and criminal remedies available. It's, for instance, law of defamation. If a person feels certain false information has caused damage to his reputation, law of defamation is available to him. It's also a common law crime of criminal injurium. And I noted there's no statutory defences are specifically prescribed for in this instance. So, again, overboard limitation on right to freedom of expression, and you already have available remedies available. So if I can quickly conclude on this first set of concerns and our specific recommendations in this regard. We believe Clause 16 and 17 should be removed in its entirety. Overboard, and like I've emphasized, you have already existing legal remedies available. If it's her intention to protect the vulnerable, for instance, school children from cyberbullying, which I believe is, or cyber harassment, we believe the focus should rather be on preventative nature. Consider what you already have. You have the Harassment Act. Inform the public more of it. Consider implementing or drafting cyberbullying policies, for instance. You could use educators, parents, and community to do it. Focus more on preventative nature and adding additional prohibitive nature, measures. But if evidence shows, and this is not our field, if evidence shows that there's a specific public need and interest for additional criminal measures, then it's very important, like I keep on emphasizing, key elements of the offence need to be clearly defined. You need to consider a uniform use of these definitions in our proposed legislation as well, and current and existing legislation. And also, we believe a prescription there should be statutory defences as well. Okay, Okay, so if I can turn to our second set of concerns, like I said. We also considered the provisions in relation to interception of communication and how it relates to and indirect impact on right to privacy and access to court. Very shortly, I'm just going to briefly state our concerns here. So if you consider Clause 38, it's intricately linked. This is now an interception of indirect communication, real-time communication-related information, and archive communication-related information. It's intricately linked to RICA. It extends the scope of RICA by amending the definition of a serious offence in RICA. But what I wish to just briefly, quickly point out, that currently this exact procedure for an interception order is being constitutionally challenged in a current North Gauteng High Court application by Angungani Investigative Journalism. And one of the key issues highlighted or being challenged is her lack of notification of an interception application or order and how this impacts on the right to access to court, as you would never know an order was taken against you, can't review its legality. Now, if you look at the bill specifically, Clause 37, it reiterates RICA's prohibition of disclosure. But what we're concerned about is this additional exception of this concept of information sharing, which is introduced in Chapter 10 of the bill. And our question is, how does information sharing impact on intercepted data? What we can see from the bill is there's an obligation on the Minister of Justice and Correctional Services now to make regulations regarding information sharing. But it says regarding cybersecurity incidents, detection, and prevention. There's too little information on how this information being shared will be stored. Will there be any independent oversight? Will there be an obligation, for instance, to destroy it after a certain period? It's unclear. Furthermore, we do also want to highlight that we find it's crucial that RICA should be reviewed simultaneously, not only for these constitutional concerns, which is it's currently at court, but also there are obvious amendments that need to be made. if you look at Clause 38, now our understanding is it does appear to try to cover that Section 205 Criminal Procedure Act loophole by requiring that the obtaining of real-time communication-related information must be in terms of RICA. Now, this is it's a very positive step, but Section 15 of RICA, which allows our procedures, our legislative means to do so, hasn't been amended yet, and it still stands. Lastly, I've been told we have to finish up. If you look at Clause 38(3)(b), Roman numerals 1 to 4, it's unclear to us regarding the obligations now for electronic communication service providers. Now, as we read it, these are specific providers who are able to store communication-related information, but they are not currently required in terms of RICA, this is now your Section 30, Subsection 2, to store communication-related information. Our understanding is, effectively, it will mean these electronic communication service providers, such as internet service providers, will be required to store all communication-related information of their clients, and there's no deliberation on specific categories of information. In this regard, we also point out there's a lack of information how this information should be stored. For instance, like I noted, there's no differentiation on kinds of communication-related information. For instance, how useful is specific information, and should maybe be a time limit in that regard. So we do believe that it unduly infringes on the right to privacy because it's so vague and it's definitely too wide. Okay, so I sort of rushed, I apologize, rushed a bit regarding the second set of concerns. But just to recap this, what our specific recommendations on this regard, we feel there's an urgent need to review RICA, not only regarding the constitutionality, but also certain amendments such as Section 15, which needs to be undertaken. We also believe there needs to be consideration on the blank prohibition of disclosure, specifically this concept of information sharing as well in the bill. There's a need for exact detail on the manner who will be in independent oversight, how will the information, for instance, be destroyed after being shared. And we, as you know, from our perspective, we are not cyber law experts, we do require clarity on obligations on electronic communication service providers in terms of this Clause 38, and for instance, how will information be stored. And in conclusion, I think my slide, I don't know where that slide went. I hope our submission was of assistance to you. We provided much more detail in our written submission. And in general, just to recap, we had two sets of concerns. Our first one related to malicious communications, which we believe specifically Clause 16 and 17 unduly infringes on the right to freedom of expression and should be removed. And our second set of concerns related to provisions in relation to the interception of communication. I hope it was of assistance to your committee, and thank you very much for your time.
When are you changing your name from Center for Human Rights to Center of Constitutional Rights and to Center of Constitutional Rights and Responsibilities?
That's a good question, but as an NGO, I think I'll direct my one to take this one.
Because, you see, I think that in this country, we also need to move a culture of rights and responsibilities, because sometimes we tend to absolutize the rights without looking at the harm that the rights can do. So I think that when we address these things, we also need to look at finding a balance. Because you can say freedom of expression. What are the limits? Rights to privacy. I can use my privacy to harbor terrorists. You see, so I think when we talk as lawyers, especially, let's try to look on both sides of the coin. Otherwise, I don't think it would be fair to ourselves and to society many people are suffering because of rights without responsibility. Thank you very much for a very eloquent presentation.
Thank you.
Honorable members, the floor is open. Other Honorable Mutapu. I will just take the names first. Honorable Mutapu, Honorable Swart, Honorable Majake.
Honorable members, you are a unit of F.W. de Klerk Foundation, isn't it? And then it appears you are not interested in seeing this the process of doing this legislation or the eventually legislation on cyber crime and cyber security coming into being. And again, it appears also, Chairperson, that they gave a scenario of laws which are in conflict with this bill. But to my surprise, they don't give proposals or alternatives. Example, the Harassment Act and the RICA. I thought maybe you also give us a proposal, or you propose that the following should then follow. But it just states the conflict in that regard. And again, I don't know, Chairperson, are they aware, in terms of SAPRIC, the South Africa is the third highest in this cyber crime. So, but when I listen to your presentation, unfortunately, it appears you are not in favor of this. And again, South Africa is a signatory, yes, we agree, to Budapest Convention, an AU Convention on Cybersecurity and Personal Data Protection, which conventions complement each other. And therefore, my understanding, Chairperson, was that the department is doing this bill in order to comply with all its international obligations. But unfortunately, in your presentation, it appears you don't come with concrete proposal on how should the department move forward in promulgation of this. Thank you, Chairperson.
In addition, you are referring to other areas being already covered by other laws. Would you say there's something wrong in consolidating what already exists in the light of this legislation, so that at a glance one is able to look and see the scope of the law? Honorable Swart.
Thank you, Chin. Thank you for the presentation. And I notice on page 3 of your presentation that you do set out that you say there is a real need for legislative measures to address the increase in cyber crimes, and you welcome the bill to the extent that it addresses legitimate concerns. So you broadly accept. You're not rejecting the whole bill. Let's put it. Secondly, you focus very clearly on Section 16 and 17, which, on my reading, is problematic. The broadness of those definitions is definitely something that we need to bear in mind. And I would like, but what the previous speaker said would be helpful if there was a way that you could suggest wording amendments to improve those aspects, particularly the first draft of your concerns relating to the impact that will have on freedoms that we have, freedom of expression at the moment, for example. I would think that if we as politicians were to, that we send SMSs or Facebook messages where we are critical politically, we could fall foul of the broadness of these definitions. For example, 17.2d, it is inherently false in nature. What do those two words in nature mean? Either it's inherently false or it's not. And aim. So there are, to me, I'm concerned about the broadness of Section 17, firstly. So I'm grateful for that, highlighting of that. The second issue is the overlapping with other pieces of legislation that you point out, such as the Equality Act, where there is a definition of harm, and here we now have a definition of harmful, which might not be in line, so there could be contradictions, and I think that is very helpful for us. We also passed the harassment bill, which would largely cover the issues here, and there is a reference in this bill in Chapter 21, where there is a possibility where a person is convicted, and the evidence applies that the Protection of Harassment Act can apply. You can apply for a protection order as well. But I would think that the department will need to explain to us at some stage as to why this criminal sanction is here in Section 17 when it is largely covered in the harassment bill already, and if the definitions are different. And then I think the point you make about RICA and the possible security services abusing their powers in terms of this is a massive concern that we need to bear in mind as responsible members of Parliament, to what degree we already see a lot of allegations against security services, and so these are valid concerns. So thank you for your input from our perspective.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. We just want to welcome the presentation of the, what's the name of the organization? Center for Constitutional Rights, yes. Your presentation indicates that you want Clause 16 and 17 to be removed. You believe that there are remedies in existence already to cater for what already has been put as part of the provision for Clause 16 and 17. My take would be that it's important for us to try and strengthen security measures to promote peace, order, and stability in South Africa. Because for us to be in the position to continue to support our constitutional democracy, there's got to be measures of promoting the three. You can have constitutional order, but if you've got a society that doesn't have peace, a society that doesn't have order, and there's no stability, but you keep on thinking that you've got constitutional democracy, it means you're actually deceiving yourself. Because basically, if you just look at the whole history of rights, where the rights comes from, beginning with the Universal Declaration for United Nations, Universal Declaration for Human Rights, the very base is peace. And if you look at what is happening for now in South Africa, you'd realize that you'd need more measures to be in the position to promote peace, order, and stability. We hear you when you're actually saying that some of the remedies exist somewhere, and you actually want to take us to the Harassment Act and other acts like the RICA. But the fact of the matter is there shouldn't be a situation where you find that there are things that are actually happening that would actually destabilize the country, that the country would not actually manage to have remedies for. And I think this is something that you actually need to note. That's very important. Thank you.
Responsibilities necessarily limit rights. Now you'll have an opportunity to respond. I'm just saying we wouldn't have rights and responsibilities unless responsibilities necessarily limit rights. You must address us as well. Honorable Bongo.
Thank you very much.
No, I was trying to
So it's Honorable Bongo. Yeah, thanks, Chair. Thank you, Chair. I think as a point of departure, we appreciate the presentation. Yeah, but one matter that I think we need to appreciate that in terms of the studies and research conducted, cybercrime has been elevated to be one of the top priorities in the continent. So I think against that background, Parliament wants to respond to that and in the interest of the people of South Africa. So part of what is our expectation from yourselves is that when you object this section or that section, you must be able to provide alternatives. Give us that this is how you want to see it, because it is a matter that everyone is always complaining about. And with yourself, it's going to be even more worrisome that we are a unit of the foundation of the former president of the republic. We've got to be more responsible, because these are very critical issues. I don't see how you want to address the issue of constitutionality and how do they affect, because this crime is a very, very serious crime. And as a committee of parliament, we want you to come up with the input. And if you say this law is conflicting with this one, you must be able to come very clear and close that this is the law that is conflicting, this is what, so that we can apply our minds and get even more research around the issues that we have raised. But right to privacy will never be above the rights of other people who are being tampered to in terms of crime. And if you look at the constitution there, you'll see how those rights are also, if you look at the constitution, that those rights, non-derogable rights, the extent to which we need to have rights being affected. So this crime is a very serious crime in the continent. We cannot just look at it from a face value level of what we interpret the constitution about. So we'll appreciate if you generally bring constructive view that will assist us draft this legislation in a manner that is upkeeping with what we're called upon to do by the people of South Africa.
Thank you so much, Honorable Chair. Well, let me also welcome the presentation and be quick to agree with Honorable Swartz that perhaps Section 17, it would have been good if you were able to reflect on the broadness of the definitions, especially when it deals with the social media regulations. And Section 17, subsection 2D, where it deals with fake news criminalization. Look, would be more appreciative if we can perhaps reflect much broader on those definitions and how can they be narrowed. I fear for one, and what is it that I fear so much? Is that the promulgation or the formulation of a bill like this flows directly from the experience of about 5 years ago of the so-called Arab Spring. That the Arab Spring was attributed in the main to the use of social media. There are those who say had it not been because of the social media, the Arab Spring would not have been of such magnitude. It would not have had such a much impact. in what is feared by governments as regime change. Now this is about a response to Arab Spring phenomenon. And how can it be contained by governments? Not only here in South Africa, but all over. And this is a conflict or a contradiction you find between the old and the young. The old are terrible about technology and the wonders that it's able to do, and want to do away with that. It's about the fear of the old when the young embraces technology and want to make use of it. Perhaps you must also reflect on, look, subsection 70 talks about fake news and the criminalization thereof. What would be your impression about fake news? Because fake news became popular with the coming of the Bell Pottinger, the guy who is now so, or the company that has become so notorious, that our social media space was flooded by fake news as a result of that campaign. What is your take on it? I guess government should be happy that to its advantage we had Bell Pottinger, right? And he brought a culture of fake news which have flooded our social media. What would be your take? Don't you think that government have a share of responsibility to take? Part of blame to take for flooding of our social media with fake news?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. The question I would like you to advise this committee on is the following. At this stage, we are sitting with a situation that there is a perception, rightly or wrongly, that, for example, our state security agency is not performing its functions and duties as it's supposed to be doing, but that it's focusing rather on the security of the state, focusing on politics and involved there. Similarly, we are well aware that, for example, in respect of the capacity of the South African Police Service, who also in terms of the bill will play a vital role, that there's a lack of capacity. While you focus on constitutional rights, to what extent is your presentation and your view on the problems with some of these sections informed by this knowledge, rather than working from an assumption that what must, that we are to view the bill in light of the theoretical situation that the state security agency will perform its duties and functions as it should be in terms of the constitution, and that we, for example, work from an assumption that the SAPs will be properly capacitated to fulfill the functions they will be getting in terms of this bill. So are the rights of the public subject to what we know is happening in South Africa at the moment, or are we as Parliament to turn a blind eye to the reality and work from the assumption that what is wrong should be fixed, and then we should purely look at whether the bill then still is problematic from a constitutional rights point of view. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to further engage, and we are going to alternatively answer the questions that you all raised. And I believe the first point that Honorable Chair had made was the point on regarding rights and responsibilities. We do agree with that notion, although, of course, we are aware of the fact that the Constitution doesn't specifically state that citizens have responsibilities. But, of course, the manner in which one reads various limitations into those rights can create the impression that they are both rights and corresponding responsibilities. And on that point, and it's a point that my colleague belabored, just the fact that even if they're rights, but that these rights can only be limited in certain justifiable circumstances. And specifically regarding the right to freedom of expression, I think the Constitution is quite clear on what the parameters of freedom of expression are. And also bearing in mind that openness is a foundational value of the Constitution, so that should always be the default position, even if we are dealing with legislation which ultimately affects the peace, security, and stability of the country, but the default position should always be openness. And if we are going to then limit the right to freedom of expression, the Constitution is quite clear that that can only be done in instances where there's propaganda for war, incitement for violence, and incitement of hatred based on race, gender, etc. And if then one is going to introduce extra grounds to limit that particular right, those grounds still need to meet Section 36 of the Constitution in that they need to be justifiable. So our point, the point that my colleague has belabored, is the fact that the limitations that the Cybersecurity Bill introduces are simply overbroad and they overshoot the constitutional recommendations for what is allowable in those circumstances.
If I say don't show my teenage children sex on television, I must wait for the Constitution to be amended.
Well, in that particular case, we're obviously talking about the interests of the child, and in terms of the Constitution, it's always the best interests of the child that need to be taken into consideration. But on the other hand, regardless of one's morals, of course, talking about sex can also be creative. It can also be one's right to artistic expression. So, of course, in that case, one would need to balance the rights, but also bearing in mind that we're talking about the rights and interests of a child, arguably, then one's child wouldn't
be. Artistic. Is there any relationship between culture and rights?
Absolutely. The Constitution does make reference to the rights to culture, but of course it does come down to the limitations clause and the question being to what extent can one practice their culture to the extent that it doesn't infringe on any other existing rights. But of course at the same time we need to recognize the various pronouncements of the courts regarding culture, regarding freedom of artistic expression.
I just want to know that because the former president and the FDM would like to share this view that you are perceiving.
Well, I like to believe that in my capacity as the director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, I am espousing values of the Constitution. I am espousing what the courts have interpreted the Constitution to mean. And in that sense, President de Klerk, having played a monumental role in the adoption of the final Constitution, it stands to reason that to some extent, as a former president and my being involved in the Constitution, it would imply that I am, in a sense, acting as his emissary in my capacity here.
Madam, I have some problems in interpretation. Are you aware that different cultures and are there in South Africa, and each one has got a right? Which culture are you dealing with? Let's take, for example, the example that you have made now of by the chairperson of showing your children.
Chairperson, a point of order. And I don't want to suppress any member now, but the fact is we had a first round of questions. Then whilst the presenters embarked on answering, you asked, by way of interjection, a follow-up, and that has now degenerated into a second round of questioning whilst the first questions have not been answered.
For elaboration, Just some calls for elaboration. Honorable.
I'm trying to find a we have got some problem in South Africa. I just want to get this thing correct. For instance, the chairperson has said, you are showing my children sex in the TV. In a liberal society, perhaps, in a different culture, it's accepted. In my culture, it's not. The question is that, in your interpretation of the rights, is it which culture you are really doing?
There are forces in the world who are trying to create a permissive society as part of the destruction of humanity. So that's why these questions are important. So we can't just say rights, rights. There must be rights and responsibilities, and a center for constitutional rights must demonstrate that it is mindful of that situation and is ready to combat such tendencies of creating a permissive society.
We, of course, do understand your concerns, but for us, the starting point is the Constitution, which acts as the higher ideal, just given the fact that by our very nature as humanity, we might have different standards as to what is applicable and what isn't, and what is acceptable in a decent civilized society and what isn't. So on that point, we rely on the Constitution, and on that specific point, I'd just like to bring the attention of the committee to the spear painting. So in terms of the spear, I think we all know what happened regarding the spear painting. And of course, that particular art is not necessarily my kind of art, and it's not something that I would hang in my home. But at the same time, I do recognize the right of the artist to artistic expression. I do recognize the fact that the Constitution protects that right to artistic expression, and even though it might be offensive, but those are the limits, in that the Constitution encourages us to push the boundaries of that freedom of expression, but ultimately it comes down to a balancing act. And once there is harm, once there is propaganda,
the interest of the children, would that act be in the best interest of the children?
Well, arguably,
I'm sorry, but you're terribly quick to protect other people who come to this committee when they've been questioned by members, yet you, yourself, interrupt these people every time they speak. Would you mind letting them answer one question at a time so that we can all hear their answers? Thank you.
Order. I think the Honourable President does not have a ground to stand when this one happens.
The Honourable Bonga, if I thought that you were capable of thought, I might be concerned.
Thank you very much, Chair. And as I was mentioning with regard to the first round of questions regarding our submission on the Cybersecurity Bill, I believe the question from Honorable Matapwa had been the fact that she wasn't particularly clear on what exactly we were asking of the committee. And in that regard, I just want to reiterate the points that my colleague, Ms. Botha, had already raised. The fact that we're advocating in the first instance that Clause 16 and Clause 17 should be dropped entirely from the bill, and that in the instance that the committee finds that the clauses should remain, we however prefer that there be more precise definitions and that there be congruence with other existing pieces of legislation. But of course, but for brevity, we would have liked to go into detail. And with the permission of the Honourable Chair, we would like to then perhaps draft our specific recommendations in that regard, if the Chair is so willing.
Replaced if you can draft and submit something, because you haven't made the case that codifying some of these laws in the context of this bill is harmful to anybody. So we'll welcome your further submission.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yes, sorry, I just want to again. So we had specific questions as well, and what I just want to highlight as well here is this bill, this proposed legislation, we are in favor of it. I think it was one of the key points said a few times. We are in favor of it, but there are certain clauses specifically which will be at risk of being declared unconstitutional by the court, by the Constitutional Court. So instead, you have to consider the Constitution, you have to consider a balancing of acts. And, you know, the chairperson kept on saying you've got rights and responsibilities. And that's exactly, the Constitution does require balancing of acts. You will consider, you can't just have an overbroad limitation on the right to freedom of expression. You need to see, for instance, if there's a specific purpose on it, it needs to be balanced out. And this can be done. But you do have a risk at a moment of these specific clauses. And we won't, in general, saying a bill is bad. We are very much in favor of it. I think if you read our written submission, like Honorable Member Swart said, we specifically emphasize that point as well. I just want to go back. So there was an overlap of one specific thing is we did not say how this can be made better. And I did try to highlight certain recommendations which our director specifically highlighted as well. I can just one or two examples. When we said we believe clause 16 and 17, remove it. There isn't a need for it. You do have the current Harassment Act. Try. I'm just going to switch this off. I'll speak loudly. Try to find means to inform the public of how the Harassment Act can be applied. Why are we not? Look at cyberbullying policy. Why hasn't that been considered? Why are you making additional prohibitive measures? And the point also raised is, for instance, the police will need to apply this as well, and you're making it very complicated as well. Going back just to, you said you can give us examples of how it could be defined. If there's a need, and we haven't seen this need, for instance, specifically, this data, if we look at clause 16 and 17, specifically clause 17 has been a recent new proposal. So this data message which is harmful. We haven't seen why there's a need for it from the public. Is it definitely in the public interest? So, but if you find it is, like we said, make sure it's clearly defined. And one example I can give you, for instance, if you consider what the Forms and Publication Amendment Bill has defined distribute as, use that example, for instance. I think it's recently to be amended, but it includes the streaming content through internet, for instance, social media. There are definitions you can use. For instance, defences. Look at public interest defence, fair comment defence. I think if you look at law of defamation or specific defences, like I said, Yes. And lastly, I would just want to, you also, because it was a point kept on saying you didn't give us examples of how we can make it better. For instance, the storing of communication-related information on provide different categories. You say there will be a view on the usefulness of information being stored and how long. It can't be this general, overall storing of all communication-related information of a client. And I hope end by saying we are in favor of this bill, but you need to balance rights here. It is right, it's in a very simplified version, it's about rights and responsibilities, but balance it. You can't say all national security or police, big cybercrimes, all, you know, this tramples would justify this infringement. I hope it's part of the system. Thank you.
I want to say again that we need a new culture which talks about rights and responsibilities. Because we can't spell out the best interests of our children. And the best interests of our children have to come first because we want to create a future for those children. If we come with all these arts and artistic words which are sophisticated which are meant to create a permissive society which destroys the children, then we're destroying society. So maybe these theories that we have will have to be workshopped from time to time to ensure that our children are safe.
I'm looking forward, like all of you, to the input of freedom of religion in South Africa.
Honourable Chair, members of the Portfolio Committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to engage with you regarding this important bill. My name is Advocate Nadine Bardnorst, and I am the in-house legal counsel of Freedom of Religion South Africa, otherwise known as 4SA, and I'm here with my colleague attorney Daniela Elebek. 4SA, just to start out with, is a non-profit organisation. We work to protect and promote religious freedom and the rights of religious communities in South Africa. And immediately in response to some of the questions and the concerns that were raised, that must include the responsibilities of the religious community. As we know of late, there's been a lot of reports regarding things that are done in the religious space that are harmful, that are dangerous, that are otherwise criminal and illegal, and 4SA is very much engaged with the process of educating religious communities with regard to the rights and their responsibilities and assisting them in developing documents and actions that would comply actually with the laws that are in place. Now, 4SA currently has a supported base of religious leaders representing approximately 6 million people in South Africa, and this is not only from the Christian faith, but it is from various denominations, churches and faith groups in South Africa. Our interest lies specifically in the bill's potential impact on freedom of religion and more particularly freedom of speech or freedom of religious expression. And in this, we are very much aligned with the position that was presented to you today by the Center for Constitutional Rights. So there may be some overlap, and I've taken note once again of the questions and concerns that were raised in response to the previous presentation, and I'll attempt to address some of those as I go along. Now, honourable members, it is indeed so that we live in, that we find ourselves in a fast and ever-expanding digital world, which does indeed present new challenges, threats and dangers, threats to national security, to public order, and even the rights of individuals. I've taken note of the comment that was made regarding the statistics of South Africa really being one of the hot spots for cybercrime, and that it's a very real issue that needs to be addressed. And as such, we appreciate the legitimate objectives of the bill. We commend the Parliament for taking up this challenge of drafting legislation that seeks to prevent and combat cybercrime and promote cybersecurity. At the outset, I want to make it very clear that we are in favour of, once again, the bill. We are in favour of what is being proposed. We are in favour of the legitimate measures that are being put in place. Yes, we need to strengthen our constitutional democracy, but our concern is that when we do that, the way that we go about doing that needs to happen within the constitutional boundaries. it needs to happen in such a way as prescribed by our constitution and interpreted by our constitutional courts. And so similar to the previous presenters, we are concerned that some of the provisions in the bill are overbroad and may have certain unintended consequences. And so we are here really to help and to navigate our way so that we can find provisions which are in fact constitutional, which will pass constitutional muster. And our particular concern relates to the provisions relating to malicious communications in Chapter 3 of the bill, particularly Section 16 and 17. Now, as a starting point, I again want us to consider Section 16 of the Constitution. I'll try not to reiterate what the previous presenters have said. But it's very important that we use Section 16 of the Constitution as the departure point when we look at the content of messages and what should or should not legally be allowed. Now, we know Section 16 guarantees the right to freedom of expression, including the right to receive and impart information or ideas. And this right applies universally in all contexts and on all platforms, including online platforms, which is what we're busy with here. Now, Members of Parliament, I do not need to remind you that freedom of speech is an incredibly important right, incredibly valued right in our constitutional democracy. Firstly, because expression is an extension of what it means to be human. It's part of our human dignity. And that includes, it must include, the ability to make up our own minds about what is good and bad, what is true and false. Secondly, and this would be very particular to us in a South African context, having regard to our own recent past, not so very long ago, of thought control, censorship, and enforced conformity to governmental theories, it is vitally important that we don't go down that same route again, that we protect almost at all costs freedom of expression in our young democracy, and that we are, as Judge Krikler said in the Constitutional Court case of State versus Mamabolo, that we are particularly astute to outlaw any form of thought control, however respectably dressed. Now, the only express internal limitation, as we can see there, that the Constitution has placed on the right to freedom of expression, and which will therefore not be protected, is those there in subsection 2A, propaganda for war, incitement of imminent violence, advocacy of hatred on certain grounds, and both elements need to be present in order to constitute hate speech proper. Advocacy of hatred that constitutes incitement to cause harm. Now, immediately in response to the question regarding the Arab Spring, of course, we can argue that those kind of speech which incited violence, which gave rise to the revolution that wanted to bring about change in government, it is arguable that those would come home under, if not propaganda for war, the incitement of imminent violence. So an argument is to be made that those kind of scenarios are already covered under what's there in the hate speech clause. Now, any other limitation on freedom of expression, as presented also by the previous speakers, must meet the requirements of Section 36 of the Constitution, which says that it has to be reasonable and justifiable, taking into account a certain number of factors, including a legitimate objective for the limitation. Secondly, and very importantly in this context, proportionality between the limitation and the purpose it seeks to achieve. And then thirdly, also, if there are, and this is written into the Constitution, so it's mandatory, if there are less restrictive means of achieving the same objective, such as already existing legislation, such as other civil law remedies, then those should be adopted instead. Now, our concern is that the proposed provisions in Section 16 and 17 of the bill, that they may unduly limit the right to freedom of expression and that they will potentially not pass constitutional muster, particularly in light of the existing and, I would submit, less restrictive legislation that achieve the same objective. Now, while we agree once again that these are all legitimate objectives that the bill seeks to achieve, our concern is that criminalization is a very serious restriction on freedom of expression. And we need to be very slow, Honourable Members of Parliament, to just criminalise speech, particularly when there are other legislation and other remedies available, civil remedies, such as protection orders, such as interdicts, such as action for damages because of defamation or financial or economic harm is suffered. So now let's first look at Section 16. Section 16 effectively makes it a crime to distribute a message and also, as we see, to send it on. So, and we know that's very common practice on social media, to retweet it, reshare it, email it on. So to distribute or redistribute a message with the intention to incite violence against a person or damage to a person's property. Now again, as the previous presenters point out, we are concerned about the fact that terms such as to make available, broadcast, and distribute have not been defined. And again, we agree also with what they've already said in terms of that it needs to be consistent with other legislation that contains similar provisions, such as the Forum and Publications Act and the proposed hate speech bill. Our difficulty, however, is that if you measure Section 16 against the Freedom of Expression Clause in the Constitution, it is clear that the definition in one sense is broader than the Constitution and in another sense is potentially narrower than the Constitution. Now, broader why? Broader in that it does not limit the crime to advocacy of hatred that constitutes incitement to harm. It simply says incitement to cause harm. Whereas the Constitution makes it very clear that incitement to harm alone will not suffice. It's not a legitimate limitation on freedom of expression. It needs to be linked. There are two components. And it needs to be the advocacy of hatred that constitutes incitement to cause harm. So in that sense, it's broader. In another sense, it's narrower than the prohibition in Section 16.2 of the Constitution. Why? In that it specifically limits the provision to a certain type of harm. And what it limits it to is violence against a person or damage to property. Whereas we know that the Constitution simply speaks about incitement to cause harm. And harm has an expansive definition. And it has been interpreted by our courts as having an expansive definition. Now, the second problem is, to some extent, what the provision seeks to achieve is already covered by other acts that are already in existence, and some of these have been mentioned by previous speakers, but if we can just look at that. And the one act that I do want to mention here is the Intimidation Act of 1982. Now, if we look at the provisions of this act, it makes it a crime for any person to, with the intention of compelling or inducing any person to do or not to do something, assault, injure, or cause damage to any person or threaten to do so. But then perhaps more closely for our purposes, or to publish words that have the effect or might reasonably be expected that the consequence thereof would be that a person perceiving those words would fear for his or her own safety or that of his or her property. So very similar to what we're trying to achieve in Section 16, although it's more tight, if I can put it that way, more narrowly defined. And the penalty in that case would be a fine not exceeding 40,000 Rand imprisonment of up to 10 years. I can just flip over, Daniela. But more than that, and again, in the context of the Arab Spring, perhaps this is something that would allay concerns. The same act also makes it a crime for a person to, with the intent of putting fear into the general public or a section of the public, for instance, farmers, commit an act of violence or threaten or attempt to do so. And violence in terms of the act is defined as inflicting of bodily harm upon or killing of or endangering of the safety of any person or the damaging, destruction or endangering of property. So again, very similar language and objectives to Section 16, although it's more tight. And the penalty there again would be a fine and or imprisonment for up to 25 years. Then the other act, which is relevant, as has already been mentioned, is the Protection from Harassment Act of 2011. And in that instance, again, we see that our courts and indeed the legislature has been slow to criminalize, in the first instance, speech that are of a harassing nature, but have rather chosen to go the route of protection orders. And then obviously if a person after a protection order has been obtained in a court of law continues the harassment at that stage, yes, it would definitely qualify as an offence in terms of the Act. And again, there we've seen in terms of that Harassment Act, harassment has a very specific definition, and it's where a person engages in conduct including, and this is not my insertion, it's actually in the Act already, it includes the sending of electronics of communication, which he or she knows or ought to have known causes harm or inspires the reasonable belief that harm may be caused. And then harm, again, is as a broader definition, it's defined as mental, psychological, physical, or economic harm.
Why not spiritual? Why not spiritual? Because we are representing a church.
I'll respond to that question later, but certainly I think in the context of what the Constitutional Court has already said regarding harm, I would believe that the definition should be broad enough to include analogous grounds, including spiritual harm. So I've already mentioned that in addition to these legislative pieces, there are other civil remedies such as an interdict, damages actions, and even in the criminal law, where harm has been committed and a person has been accessory to that criminal act being committed, in the sense that the person has aided or abetted the crime by inducing it, by encouraging it, by counseling how to commit the crime, by giving advice or stirring up the crime. In criminal law already, that in itself would be a criminal offence for a person who's acted in that way as an accessory. So in the circumstances, Honourable Members of Parliament, we would submit that this clause is potentially unnecessary. It would result not because it doesn't achieve legitimate objectives, but because it results in a duplication of already existing legislation, and potentially also because it's unconstitutional in the sense that it goes broader than what is envisaged by the Constitution. Now, again, that is not to say that there may not be other limitations on freedom of speech other than those that are mentioned in Section 16.2 of the Act. But those, I would submit, need to be dealt with on a case-by-case basis under Section 36 of the Constitution to see whether it is indeed reasonable and justifiable, taking into the account the factors mentioned there. If the Members of Parliament are not with me and believe that after all, despite the fact that existing legislation is in place that already achieves these objectives, then I would submit that it would be necessary to look at a narrowing down and a tightening of this definition, and perhaps it could be achieved in such a way as to mirror the language of the Constitution. And I apologize, I should have in my submission included specific suggested wording, but with leave of the committee, if I may make a supplementary submission and propose such alternative wording, but it would be something along the lines of any person who unlawfully, and then with the intention to incite makes available a data message that amounts to the advocacy of hatred that constitutes incitement to cause harm. So I think it's very important to have consistent language, again with a view to legal certainty, so that both the police, who ultimately need to investigate and prosecute these matters, and members of the public at all times are aware of what is the threshold, and that we don't have different pieces of legislation using different words and thereby implying different thresholds for civil or criminal liability. I want to move on to Section 17, which deals with harmful messages. Thank you, Chair. Now, Section 17, to some extent, is very similar to Section 16. It also deals with potential damage to property and violence, except that it doesn't relate to incitement, but to threatening words. Now, again, threatening, as I pointed out, is covered by those very acts which I've mentioned, Intimidation Act, Harassment Act. Of greater concern, however, is the following. Of course, it is undesirable that people should threaten one another with violence and property damage. But in principle, I submit to you that law should criminalize harm actually being done rather than the potential of harm. The concern is on the provisions as they currently stand, even exaggerated speech or satirical speech could potentially be criminalised. For instance, if I were to, as I'm sure happens in Parliament a lot, as I've seen on TV, if someone were to say by way of gesture to someone else, I'll kill you if you do that, or I'll break your neck if you do that, on social media or in a media article, that could potentially be harmful. That could potentially be criminal in terms of these provisions, and that would be a chilling threat to freedom of speech. Turning then to Section 17.1c of the bill, which makes it a crime to send or resend a message that intimidates, encourages, or harasses a person to harm themselves or someone else. Again, while we appreciate the bona intention of the bill to protect vulnerable people from online harassment, again, our concern is that this could have a chilling effect on freedom of speech, which includes robust expression that is often crude, aggressive, unpleasant. Again, if someone were to say to another online, I don't agree with you, go jump off a bridge, which we all would understand as generally as leave me alone or break a leg, which again is generally understood as a good love message.
Generally agreed in some cultures, not in all cultures.
But potentially, Mr. Chair, the problem is that could be criminal again on the interpretation of the person who is seized with this charge and with the investigation and the prosecution of it. That could criminalize innocent people. And that is our concern, the unintended consequences. Now, that isn't rescued by the provision in Section 17 of the Bill where it says, and a reasonable person in possession of the same information and with regard to all these circumstances would regard the data message as harmful. Because once we've defined harmful, a reasonable person would read that message as, yes, it threatens a person with, you know, that I'll break their leg. And that has already been considered harmful. So it's a circular argument. Rather, if one wants to tighten and improve and strengthen the definition, it would be, what would a reasonable person have understood that to mean? Our courts have already found that freedom of expression includes not only information or ideas that are favorably received or regarded as inoffensive or as a matter of indifference, but also those that offend, shock, or disturb. That is the Rief versus Director of Public Prosecutions in the Constitutional Court in 2004. So again, with such communication, it's not just offensive, but truly harassing in the legal sense of the word. It should be dealt with ideally in terms of other legislation. Now, if I might bring it closer to home, Mr. Chair, just before I conclude with a few words, to the religious context. Now, you may be aware of a church, a well-known church and a reputable church in South Africa, who's been taken to task to the Human Rights Commission because they taught the scriptures on child correction in the home. You know, the scriptures that we all would know from the Bible, typically mentioned as spare the rod and spoil the child. You know, folly is bound up in the heart of a child and the rod of correction drives it away. Now, already there's a church in South Africa who's been taken to the Human Rights Commission because it was said that to simply preach about those scriptures, to mention those scriptures in a church context, that incites violence against children, that is child abuse. Now, the Human Rights Commission, you may or may not know, actually found that is indeed the case. And it found that the church is no longer allowed to preach and teach those scriptures, which they believe to be harmful.
Why were they not taken to the CRL Commission? Why to the Human Rights Commission?
Your case is as good as mine, Mr. Chen. We would submit that absolutely that should have been the case, because clearly that is something that squarely falls within the mandate of the CRL Commission. We in fact subsequently did bring out a report where they said they do not agree with what the Human Rights Commission has said. But be that as it may, so on the construction of this bill as it currently stands, where it says it intimidates, encourages, or harasses a person to harm himself or any other person, potentially that clause could be used to catch a church who advocates or who preaches these scriptures, because what they could say is you're not preaching scriptures which encourage parents to harm children on their interpretation of the effects of corporal punishment, which we know there are social science studies both ways, but on the particular interpretation, and you refer to the very liberal and permissive trend which we see in our society, and a lot of people do interpret those practices which are done out of love for the good of children, not to harm them, but actually to be for their good, as harmful.
Isn't the problem that there are too many holy scriptures claiming to come from the same God, and God cannot speak different languages on the same issue?
Yes.
Now, which one should we take as sacrosanct?
And that, Honourable Chair, is of course something that particularly we as an organisation defend, the freedom of religion to believe. And there I want to make it very clear that, and we do always say that does not mean that anyone is allowed to hide behind the freedom of religion banner in order to commit dangerous, harmful, criminal, or otherwise illegal acts. But it does mean, as our Constitutional Court has already said in the case of Prince, the Rastafarian, that people must be free to believe, no matter how bizarre, illogical, or irrational. But in fact, when harm obviously comes in, then the state has a duty to interfere. But other than that, people must be free to make up their own minds as to what God is saying and what he's not saying.
That's what we seek to do now, to criminalize so that there's a limit to what can be done ahead. Honourable members, Honourable Schwartz has declared that is close to this organization is like me. I come from the Southern African Interfaith Council. I'm a religious person, and but I'm not going to suppress anybody. Honorable Swart.
No, Chair, thank you. Yes, and thank you for the presentation. I would look forward to the suggested wording to improve the bill. Should the suggestion not be accepted that the sections 16 and 17 be removed, how to narrow it down? That's the first issue. And then secondly, you also in paragraph 6.7, you propose that certain defences, common law defences, be included here as well. And I think that is important also to look at proposed wording. And the last aspect which you didn't get to was the issue of the broad powers and responsibilities of the state. Again, it would be helpful to suggest some wording to narrow down to make sure that there are sufficient checks and balances as one looks to try to resolve the issues that we faced with. So thank you for the presentation.
No, thank you, Honourable.
Any other? Honourable Matthias, any other? Proceed. Honourable Mpungwan, any other? Then we will catch the men with us today.
I don't know whether you change the council, depending on your audience. The other time you said you are spiritual, not religious, but today you say
thank you for reminding me.
Sometimes these two words are used interchangeably, but I'm spiritual, not religious.
Well, look, two observations. Why do you refer to farmers in particular? Why you had no any other example to cite except farmers as potential victims of hate speech or hate crimes and all of that. Not that I've got anything against farmers. Honorable Swartz has got many friends, relatives who are farmers and farm owners, so I've got nothing against them, except that the land question remains a burning question. Secondly, you are making an example about a scripture which was presented in the form of a sermon in a church. Isn't that this piece of legislation is about regulating any statement, any message which is conveyed through these tools and platforms that are described in the legislation, and excludes anything that is said in an open meeting like this? I can say something now in an open meeting like this, and I will be protected in terms of the Constitution. But the moment that I have said in this open meeting is converted into a face, into a WhatsApp or into a Facebook or into an internet, then I'll be in conflict with the proposed legislation. Isn't that so? So why should you be concerned about what is being preached in an open church sermon? Just for clarity. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Minister. In relation to your first question, why did I cite farmers? You are indeed correct. I could have cited a host of different examples. I could have cited, for instance...
The approach is that we have to take...
Apologies, Chair.
It's not...
Lady, I noticed that you worried about the duplication of existing laws. I personally see no harm in putting two padlocks to lock your house. If you are able to crack one, don't crack the other one. I don't see any problem in that, and if that is the only one,
You seem not to be having that alone. You also seem to be very keen on assisting the courts in interpreting the laws. They will have difficulties. I understand and I appreciate your generosity. I think it is their duty to do that. I have noticed that you talked about the law must not criminalize harm done, not potentially to be done. I do still have a problem in that. I think if I hear something, somebody through WhatsApp, whatever, that immediately I see it, it harms me. I don't see the difference between potential and actual harm. I'm actually harmed by the distribution of that. And also, notice there are problems in this country which started more than 100 years ago. I'll bring this thing because you are a religious body. When the religious people came into this country, they said the African religion is a heathen religion, and that the best religion is the one that they are bringing. And that the best people will be those that believe in this religion. And even the courts used to say, you can practice your own so-called culture if it is not contrary to the morals and good standards of civilization. And that has been the conflict all along. In 1994, that culture, which was supposed to be civilized culture and civilized religion, was on the upper hand. And now when the other one is trying to say, we are also there, South Africans. No, wait a minute. It's not. That's about the freedom of expression and the freedom of religion, which is in terms of what we understand to be. So, there is in the Constitution freedom of religion, but depends which religion. This conflict appears in all your understanding and interpretation of people must talk as they feel like, and so on. This is maybe not the thing that we can discuss here. You probably need to have an MBO, where people talk about this. But it is very, let me let you know, very painful if you belong to the people whose culture is literally oppressed. I want to make an example of the other thing that you say, there was this thing. In my culture, you cannot go to and insult an adult. Because the important thing to us the division in our culture is not based on money, on status, is based on age. It's very serious. Now, in so-called liberal culture, you can say anything to an adult and insult him. People feel, for example, when the president is being insulted, they feel bad about it. That's very legal. How do you insult an adult like that? And it's acceptable. You now talk about culture, artistic, you know, you must depict so-and-so as you like. So there is this conflict. You must be understanding. And I say to you, to people who believe that you cannot do things to adults and it is acceptable, it's very painful. We move from the oppression of physical oppression to psychological oppression. And I want you to be aware of this thing. And I want you to take care of all this. Now, we are here trying to form a common South African culture of understanding. We are basically 80%, if not 90%, European culture. And it is acceptable. And that people who are trying to say, no, no, wait a minute, we also exist. No, 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 no. The Constitution must protect this freedom, but not the other freedom. That is the problem we have. Not only on this particular thing. I heard you. I heard the other speaker was here. All of them, they're talking about freedom. We must do this. Freedom. Liberal. And question is that, whose freedom? And who must we say is what is acceptable? You know, you see, you sure what I mean? There are other things that were happening, maybe, I don't know when you're still young, that were there before it was physical. You know, we could not go on the pavement. It was a crime for an African to move on the pavement in Cape Town. But that move now, you can move on the freedom. But as far as your culture is concerned, get out of the pavement. Thank you very much.
Many people in this country, the indigenous people, are like me. I don't believe that my parents and their parents are dead. I believe that I can communicate with them every day in the Christian churches. People are preaching against ancestors, ancestor worship. And should that be allowed to continue? Many children are suffering from depression. They take drugs because their parents are being threatened. Someone says, we'll break your necks, we'll burn you alive. And you say, potential threat should not be criminalized. Do you think that is inclusive? Your protection is inclusive of all these aspects.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. If I may quickly respond to the question that came from the Honourable Matthias. The first question related to why specifically did I mention farmers as a group. Now, correctly, I could have mentioned a host of other examples. My intention was to refer to an example that we all may be familiar with because of the particular news coverage that it has enjoined of late, and in particular and an instance where the Constitutional Court has in fact already found that something like kill the farmer, kill the Boer qualifies as hate speech. So I use that example as a measure to bring legal certainty. It's not an issue that's still debatable, that's grey, it's something on which the court has already found. But correctly, I could have pointed out, if I wanted to use other current events, a group of persons such as journalists who of late have suffered threats and intimidation, or I could have used LGBT people. I could have used LGBT people who, as we know, in some aspects also a group who from time to time suffer threats of violence and corrective rape. I could have used religious groups who themselves have been subject to similar threats. So it was really by way of example, but I could have used a whole number of. Secondly, in relation to your question regarding the sermon in church and whether a sermon that takes place from pulpit in church isn't outside the scope of this particular legislation. I take your point. However, what happened in the particular scenario that I referred to was that those sermons were in fact made available, as a lot of churches do, on the internet for members to listen to. And in fact, it emanated from a manual, a parenting manual that was placed online as well for parents, how to be better, godly parents who love their children. And it was obtained by liberal activists who drive an anti-religion agenda, and on the basis of what was indeed published on the digital space, they made a case against the church with the Human Rights Commission. And it's those exact kind of scenarios that we want to prevent. In relation to the question from the Honourable Mzungwa regarding the question of whether it's not better to have two padlocks to lock your house, I mean, in other words, the question relating to the duplication of existing legislation. And indeed, I have no issue if there is a reference, as there is already in the Act, to the Harassment Act, but I do think it needs to be made explicitly clear, perhaps by an introductory paragraph, even at the beginning of this bill, where it refers to the objectives of the bill, where it specifically refers to, for instance, the Intimidation Act and the Harassment Act. And then again, with a view to legal certainty, both for the public who may fall victim to the provisions of the Act, and for the police who will be tasked with the investigation of the criminal charges brought in terms of the Act, and the prosecuting authorities, it's important that there's legal consistency. And that's really my concern, that there aren't different thresholds in law so that people would know when in fact am I guilty of inciting harm or inciting violence. And it's important, therefore, that the different pieces of legislation speak to one another. And that is my concern. In terms of the observation that was made that you see that my concern is to assist the courts with interpretation of legislation, the difficulties that may have, and indeed I do think that is a concern that we do need to take into account when we draft legislation, because ultimately we know that if legislation isn't certain, especially it opens itself up to abuse. It opens itself up to abuse by people who drive a particular agenda and who will use that legislation that's perhaps not carefully crafted to achieve their own objectives. But it could also lend itself to abuse from the bench, said with all respect. I think in our country we've seen many instances of judicial activism, and therefore I do think that we need to be careful to make sure that when has to deal with a particular piece of legislation, it has to interpret it, that it in fact interprets it in line with what the legislature originally had in mind. With regard to your comment that law must criminalize actual harm rather than potential harm, again, I see the objective. I believe it's a legitimate objective to prevent people from potential harm. Again, my comment would just be that we need to be very slow to criminalize threats of harm, particularly in circumstances where there is existing legislation that already deals with incitement and intimidation and so forth. With regard to your comment on African religion and the history where African religion has been made out to be a heathen religion and so forth, I couldn't agree with the Honourable Member more that in South Africa, as it says in our constitution, South Africa belongs to all who live in it, united in our diversity. And therefore it doesn't mean that we should all think the same, that we should all believe the same, that we should all give expression to our beliefs in the same way. That is the beauty, I would submit, of the Rainbow Nation in which we live, that there is room for accommodation of it has a capacity for plurality, it has a capacity for diversity. And the thing that makes us unique in South Africa is our ability to create room for that accommodation of a plurality. And indeed, that is what is entrenched in our constitution, where Section 15, for instance, speaks of the freedom of freedom to believe. And I will really refer to the way in which this is being interpreted by the Constitutional Court as people must be free to believe, even if it's bizarre, illogical, or irrational. So people may, in other religions, do very strange things, which I don't understand, which I don't agree with, which I may even find highly offensive, Honourable Chair. But that is their freedom to believe. And it must be protected unless those things become harmful or criminal or otherwise illegal. There the state has a duty to step in. But I take note of the suggestion that was made regarding Imbiza. I think it's a very good suggestion. I think it's something that I will definitely take up with the CRL Rights Commission, who is a friend to our organization as well, And I think it's definitely something that we need to have a conversation about in this country so that we can actually create a narrative of accommodation, of respect for the other, of the capacity to accommodate the other even when we don't agree. And unfortunately, as the Honourable Member has pointed out, and also in response to the previous presenters, in South Africa we do see this trend of almost where there's a new narrative, a liberal narrative that has been created, and that alone almost is said to pass constitutional muster. But that's not correct, because the Constitution, again, creates the space where people can, from across different traditions, different religions, different worldviews, there should be the ability for us to respect one another's beliefs. Honourable Chair, just in response to your question, which was the very last question, where you mentioned also the Indigenous people and what is sometimes being said regarding ancestry and communication with the dead in churches. And again, perhaps a very, very relevant example to use to explain how the interplay of rights would work in this instance is the Grace Bible Church scenario, which some of us may have read about in the news, where the Idols presenter, Samizi, can't remember his surname now, he basically was in the Grace Bible Church, and there was a guest preacher who on that day spoke against homosexuality and said that while God loves all people, that he doesn't approve of homosexuality. And this Idols presenter, himself being an LGBT person or supporter of the LGBT community, he took great offense to what was being said. And immediately he walked out of the church, and immediately he started tweeting on social media, making his protest known, and he said, in fact, I'm not coming back to church. I'm going to another church. And that is exactly how constitutional rights, I would submit, should work in this country. The church, in terms of the constitution, has the right to freedom religious freedom, to believe what they believe according to the Bible, to make up their own minds regarding what the Bible says, and freedom of religious expression.
Shouldn't they teach their own teaching and leave out other people? If you are teaching Christianity, why do you make it your business to talk about my relationship with my ancestors? Because that is my area.
Honourable Chair, if I may just finish what happened in the idol scenario. And then, as I said, the idol judge stormed out and immediately started tweeting. And there he exercised his right of freedom of expression. And he exercised his right of freedom of association when he said, I'm never coming back to this church, I'm going to another church. And that's exactly how it should work, I would submit, in a constitutional democracy, where we all have rights and we have to respect one another's rights and not enforce our particular rights on another, but create room for them. And if we're not happy, then we go exercise our rights as he did, then in the context of another church who does hold to the same views that he does. And just then in relation to your specific comment, some churches and many churches would believe that they have to preach the full counsel of God. In other words, everything that the Bible says. And some of them do interpret the Bible as placing a prohibition for Christians on speaking with the dead. And again, that would be perhaps for most Christians, but not necessarily for all Christians, or for some religious people, but not for all. And again, the mere fact that some people would hold to that as a biblical belief does not mean that that others may not hold to that belief. And there should be a respect for the fact that we can believe differently. And I thank you, Honourable Chair, for your time.
Chairperson? I request for 5 minutes break, but we are so many that if we break, just to come back is going to take more time. Those who want to go to the restroom, why don't they go? Those who want to have a drink and go and have a drink, but the proceedings must continue. With your permission.
Chairperson? To say that maybe when the presenters come, if they feel that some of the aspects of their presentation have been covered by that organization, they should mention so if they are available in the house.
Okay. Yeah. And I mean, I don't know if we want to stand on the agenda in cancer. I mean, when it was before in cancer, it was a different scenario. Now we're dealing with a big piece that's going to be escaped. We might want to stand on the responsibility to it. We want to stand on it in the form of an affidavit, an answering affidavit, and give Intercell the opportunity to apply.
I think we should discuss that as well, to what extent, because the TRIPS has now taken this as they've taken the previous thing to just correspondence actually, and they've taken this as a problem of saying before the meeting, and I think that's wrong, because
we haven't put everything in there.
And if the complainant calls something in quarter and just take that same thing, and don't even change it, just don't believe it now.
Yeah, I mean, when we were responding to ICASA, we were responding to the impact. You know, we don't know if we have any points that we would wish to cover. You know, we don't know what the themes are. It's all over the place. Alleging everything. One moment he's talking about privacy. The next moment he's talking about something else.
And I mean, the thing is things are like both. You know, both issues. And then these are the clue certain BRC. She just thought it in Minnesota. Like you said, we don't see it as a proper complaint and notification.
Is Intercell going to be represented, for example? You know? Do we have a pre-hearing prior to this 19th and 20th hearing to actually assess what is in dispute and what are we answering to? So many questions lingering that I've just...
Honourable members and... can we all take our seats and proceed with our work? Right to know. Yes, from you.
What number is it?
The third one.
Good morning, honourable members and chairperson. We represent the Right to Know campaign here today, and we thank you for your time and indulging us in this submission. I'm here together with members of the study group who look at these issues within the Right to Know campaign. Myself, Mary Hunter to my right, and Azad Desai to my left. Quickly introduce the Right to Know to those of you who may not know about the Right to Know or our work. The Right to Know was launched in 2010 in August, and we recently noted 7 years of existence, and we exist to
help you start a regulator.
Yes. Right to Know exists to as a movement to advocate for freedom of expression and the free flow of information. And we see this as a fundamental right within our democracy, as something that's necessary for people to advance their other needs for social, economic, or political freedoms, as well as for equality and dignity. Our vision for the Right to Know says that we seek a country and a world where we all have the right to know, that is, to be free to access and to share information, and this right is fundamental to our democracy, that is open, accountable, and is participatory. Regarding the bill that is before us today, Right to Know has been engaging with this process since 2015, when the first version of the bill was released by the Department of Justice. At the time, Right to Know rejected the bill in its entirety because we saw that the bill itself had deep and fundamental flaws that threatened our democratic space, but as well as the democratic spirit of the internet. We do acknowledge, however, that there has been progress made in the amendments to the bill, including the removal of the more egregious secrecy bill clauses in the previous versions of the bill. Right to Know submission, which honourable members would have seen by now, is premised on the belief that a free and open internet is crucial for the full realisation of other rights. It is our view that the internet holds the power to democratize knowledge and access across society. We do, of course, acknowledge that there is a deep digital divide within our society, which is why we advance other campaigns around, for instance, Start to Move 4. We also realize that the potential for the internet to be this democratizing and open access platform in order for others to gain access to knowledge and information has not been fully realized. And part of it is because of laws such as the Cybercrimes Bill in its current form will potentially censor online content and take us backwards in terms of the current progress and gains that we have made. We're also concerned about the overreach of corporates as well as the state and the state executive. The state executive infringing on the kinds of gains that we've made through internet freedom. And therefore, we strongly believe that the public and Parliament has got its work and role to defend internet rights. To focus specifically on what our concerns are, the current bill, we say, if passed into law, will infringe on these rights and our attempts to, and although there needs to be, we do agree that there needs to be an active engagement to ensure that cybercrimes, we recognize the presence of cybercrimes in our society, the current bill is not framed in a way that both adequately deals with cybercrimes but then also violates other fundamental rights. So then what is needed? Our first point of departure is that, as others have said this morning, is that the bill needs to be much more narrowly and clearly drafted. So we need precise wording in order to avoid the potential abuses and censorship which will stifle public participation and infringe on other legitimate online activism. We also believe that there should be much stronger safeguards to ensure that state invasions on privacy and the overreach of state security structures is kept at bay. We also hold the view that, particularly relating to the cyber security aspect of the bill, that state security is given an inappropriate role in stewarding our cyber security architecture. We believe that this role should be moved to a public body which has got civilian oversight, which is more open, accountable, and is democratically controlled. Our submission covers three areas. The first is around freedom of expression. The second is freedom from surveillance. And the third deals with cybersecurity. I'll be dealing specifically with our concerns around the infringement on freedom of expression. Chapter 3 of the bill, which aims to regulate malicious communications, we believe is particularly problematic around its regulation around what is deemed harmful content. We recognize, however, that protecting freedom of expression is a very complex task, and I think we've seen this come through in the discussions this morning. There are, however, ways in which to draft legislation which ensure that freedom of expression is balanced with other needs within society. This bill in its current format, we need to emphasize this, is problematic in its legal framework, particularly in defining what is harmful content. Our concern also is that government has previously proposed regulating social media. We heard this from our Minister of State Security, or has been associated with state security, and we saw a huge public outcry to this, ironically, on social media. Our four key areas, which in relation to freedom of expression, are first around inciting or are first around. The clauses which deal with inciting or threatening violence and damage to property. This is dealt with in Section 16 and 17 of the bill. Now, we see this as problematic, and we say that in principle, any law which prohibits speech because it could cause harm should be rejected. We secondly point out the problematic aspects around, and this has been raised this morning already, around online harassment, which is dealt with in Section 17 of the bill. Now, we agree that this section of the bill is far too broad in its current draft, in its current wording, and we believe that the problem around this particular area of the bill is that it doesn't sufficiently engage with how robust political discussion happens within society, where often what could be deemed as insulting or offensive language is used as part of democratic discussion and part of social discourse. We also believe in our view that the already existing Protection of Harassment Act of 2011 sufficiently provides for law around this area, and includes clauses around harassment on the internet and on telecommunication platforms, and then also provides a particular clause for when the harassment order is not obliged with becomes a criminal offence. We believe that the current bill then introduces additional criminal liability, which is not necessary. The Cybercrimes Bill also could be seen as government's attempts to deal with what has become the problem of fake news in Section 17. Broadly speaking, again, Right to Know believes that this should be completely removed from the bill because it will potentially allow the state to police the truth. And by this we mean that the state should not have the role of deciding what is and is not true, as this could fundamentally curtail freedom of expression as a human right, which includes the freedom to be wrong in a democratic society. And then more importantly, we are concerned that the political climate that we find ourselves in could make this particular clause very, very open to abuse. Just to make some quick final comments on this, we also have concerns around the clauses which relate to sending and receiving messages which could be seen as harmful. And we say that this does not sufficiently address what could be, does not sufficiently address resending of a message and the intention of the resender of those messages. I'm just going to wrap up very quickly here. Overall, we believe that the entire the clauses in section 16 and 17 should be removed in their entirety. We do, however, acknowledge the important work that's been done on section 18, which deals with the distribution of intimate content, what is known as revenge porn. And the only thing that we would like to say about this is that this has been provided in the Film Publications Amendment Bill, and we would say that in the Film Publications Amendment Bill, this should be removed. I'm going to hand over to my colleague. Molly.
Chairperson, very briefly, I'd like to just outline, I think this has been raised in one of the previous presentations, but I think we do need to talk about how the Cybercrimes Bill would relate to existing surveillance laws, in particular RICA. I think it's important to take the context where there is growing concern and growing abuse that the state's surveillance powers are not sufficiently regulated, but also that even though those regulations exist, that there are unchecked practices and unchecked abuses that we need to be cognizant of and that this bill needs to take into account. This is because obviously the primary purpose of the Cybercrimes Bill is to protect ordinary citizens, ordinary people from attacks and crimes. Reddit envisages as being crimes from private individuals, criminal syndicates. But when it comes to cybercrimes, not only in South Africa but globally, we need to recognize that there are situations where a government is not only the protector but also sometimes the perpetrator. Let's look quickly at RICA, because the bill, Section 38 of the bill, would attempt to reform RICA. I think it's useful for us to just recognize that RICA is subject to a constitutional court challenge now because of some of the abuses we've seen, where we see that the bill lacks transparency, where the judicial oversight that's been put in place, the RICA Act lacks transparency and oversight, and the judicial oversight that's put there really to protect citizens or targets the surveillance against unlawful abuses has not been sufficient in actually checking those abuses. So we see case studies that have come out in court documents that are very well documented, for instance, of journalists being targeted, not because they're suspected of crimes, but because they're a journalist and their investigative work is under scrutiny, where whistleblowers are facing the same sorts of threats of being spied on by either actors within the state or actually sanctioned operations within a government agency. And I think it's also important to note, given the political climate, that this is not something that only affects civilians, but it's something that political leaders and elected leaders may also be targets for. It's certainly something that we hear a number of political leaders have begun to state openly that they believe that their communications is being spied on. So the Cybercrimes Bill attempts to address some modest reforms in RICA. And just for the purposes of brevity, I won't go into all of the reforms we've actually recommended for RICA, but they are spelled out on page 9 of our submission. What we understand Section 38 of this bill to do is, number one, to implement a part of RICA which hasn't yet been implemented, if we understand, which is that not only your telephone service provider, but your internet service provider would be required to store information about you and your activities over the internet. Unfortunately, one of our recommendations for RICA is that data preservation shouldn't be happening. To give a case study, if a member sitting in this room today signed up to MTN, Telkom, Vodacom, your service provider, by law, your service provider has been storing information about who you've been communicating with over the last 3 to 5 years. So a phone call that you made 5 years ago may still be on the server of your cell phone provider, but not only the calls and messages you exchanged and the communication you had, but also your location. So if someone was able to access that information, they have a very detailed record of who you've communicated with, where you slept that night, where you went the next morning, who you've been meeting with. It's a very detailed profile of who you are as a person. We've seen in other jurisdictions that sort of data retention has actually been struck down. It was recently struck down in the EU Court of Human Rights as being not the interception of that data, but the preservation of that data actually being a violation of people's privacy when it's untargeted. This is happening to millions of people, none of whom are actually suspected of committing a crime. So that's all to say that First Amendment to RICA that we see in Section 38 to store people's internet traffic is actually, we believe, not something that should be contemplated. The second is what we would say is a modest and welcome amendment, is to close what we call the Section 205 loophole. RICA is one act that governs surveillance in our country, but as was mentioned earlier, Section 15 of RICA says that there are other, irrespective of the surveillance procedures that are spelled out in RICA, in terms of the Criminal Procedures Act, you can also access all of that data that I was just mentioning using a magistrate at the lowest levels of our courts in order to intercept, to get records of who someone has been communicating with or where they were located. Now, what we understand the closing of the loophole to be is that this will no longer happen under the procedures of Section 205 of the Criminal Procedures Act. It will all go through RICA. However, we've already spelled out that we're concerned that the RICA judge is not sufficiently capacitated to do the kind of oversight we need, not sufficiently resourced. We've recently determined that the Section 205 requests that are happening through the magistrate's courts are happening many, many thousands of times a year. So where the RICA judge is processing something in the region of about 700 warrants a year, the magistrates are processing something in the region of 30 to 50,000 warrants a year to intercept people's communications. So if that loophole is being closed, we're concerned that a judge that was previously having oversight over roughly 700 requests will now be detailing 30, 40, 50 times that number of requests. And there's a big question about how that will be feasible without a dramatic restructuring of the office.
In this modern society, when you are dealing with international terrorism, sophisticated, do you expect the magistrates in the rural areas can protect society? They will leave society to the protection of the magistrates who don't even have typewriters and say they can help society to defend itself against terrorism?
Chairperson, maybe we should engage that in the questions and answers, but I will just state that it's actually RICA that's given that power to the magistrates. It's not what we're proposing. It's one of the concerns we have with the current legal framework. I think that has been mentioned that when it comes to the protection of any right, the freedom of access to information, freedom of expression, and the right to privacy, there has to be a balancing act, and we acknowledge that. Our concern is that under the current framework, that balance isn't there. We're concerned that balance isn't being respected, and so we're asking for legal reforms to actually manage that. And that would be a full and urgent reform of the provisions in RICA, and we've spelled that out in pages 9 and 10 and we can make additional supplementary submissions as well. I'm just going to hand over to Azhar, who's going to speak about some other practices that we also feel are unregulated here.
I should be very brief then. The one other factor that we feel has been unregulated, I'll just set aside for a moment the questions of law and just talk about our daily practices when we, with the kind of privacy that we expect from our cell phones and computers when we use them every day. I mean, we have quite stringent expectations that what goes on there remains on those devices or on the devices of people we're communicating with. But there's one particular piece of software which I'd like to mention. I just want to talk about the existing technological practices. There's one particular set of software that I need to mention called FinFisher. And the reason I want to mention it is that, A, it violates some of these privacy expectations. It can violate some of these privacy expectations we have for some of our devices. And the evidence strongly suggests that it is being used in South Africa at the moment. The earliest reports came in 2014 when people... the earliest report came in 2014 when there were some documents leaked on WikiLeaks that suggested that the South African state had been using FinFisher. But there was subsequent evidence that more strongly elaborates a case most recently in 2015 where researchers actually discovered an instance of this software running locally in the country. And the reason, so what's worrying about the software is the software is designed specifically to help people breach our cell phones and laptops with the purposes of, say, spying on WhatsApp conversations or spying on emails. Now, I don't mean to bring this up to cause mass hysteria or cause any panic. I mean, in truth, these are not mass surveillance tools, these are targeted surveillance tools, and generally you'd use them against a few people. But it isn't comforting for some members of our society, such as whistleblowers and even such as political leaders, who are worried about some of these concerns. So we'd like to ask, though, that the members of the committee to consider whether an example such as this should be lawful or should not be lawful, or under what oversight should be in place for the use of such tools, because at the moment it seems it's quite underregulated.
Chairperson, quickly to wrap up, because I know that time is not our friend. I think that there's a very important aspect that we want to mention, which is the second half of the bill, which deals with cybersecurity. We've been dealing with the parts that deal with cybercrimes. We believe that far too much power is given over to the state security structures to develop and oversee cybersecurity policies in terms of this bill. And I'll just mention one example, which is with regard to protecting the privacy of our networks and our infrastructure. Chapter 11 of the bill spells out the provisions that we call critical information infrastructure, which essentially allows the state security structures to identify any infrastructure. It could be a device, it could be a network, it could be a building, and it could belong to local government, national government, or it could belong to a private entity, and to declare that critical infrastructure, and then to set directives that entity must deal with.
You are well prepared. I'll offer you an opportunity to make further written submissions. And then it will be duly considered. But time doesn't allow us to proceed.
Sure. Yeah. The Chairperson, I would just say that it wouldn't be necessary for us to make additional submissions on that. From page 16 onwards, we deal with that, and we ask for those provisions to be withdrawn.
Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
Honorable
member,
right to know against the Privacy Act 2014.
Thank you, Chair. I would like just try to know to maybe respond to a statement to say that I get the sense that while obviously much of what they say are very helpful, that they come at us through an angle solely focusing on rights once again. And we all know about the limitation clause and that it must be reasonable, justifiable in an open and democratic society. But in addition to that, I think it's a fairly common understanding now that one of the purposes of a limitation could also be to reinforce the foundational values of our Constitution. And that now takes one, for example, to their stance on the fake news provisions, where they say that they reject this outright. But what if we are faced with a situation, for example, that fake news accelerates to the extent that it may even impact on the outcome of an election? And our democracy, our young democracy being dear to us all, wouldn't that then at least create a situation where the limitation clause must force us to take into consideration measures against fake news, for example? This is Chair, but one example, but obviously I would like them to just address us in general as to, in their view, when and how will the limitation clause come into play, because not to be unfair to them, but I sort of get the sense that they so solely focus on rights that in their view the limitation clause is almost impossible to come into play. Thank you.
In other words, would you accept that it's not only the right to know, there has to be limitation even to that right to know? Honorable Matthias?
Chair, look, man. Well, I'm grateful that they have emphasized the point on the need to understand the digital divide, especially as a tool to enable effective and efficient communication between various stakeholders, more especially between different generations. And the digital divide and the space to enhance communication should be seen as an enabler than a disabler. And I hope that the older generation like myself and Honorable Dr. Mutsefa understands the role of technology. Look, you are making some observations around Section 16 and 17 on social media regulation. And majority of presenters who spoke or who presented before you also spent some fair enough time on Section 16 and 17. In your presentation, you are making 2 points. One, that the bill tries to prevent online harassment, incitement of violence, bullying, by criminalizing malicious communication. But if you further goes on to say, however, this raises huge freedom of expression problems. What are those problems that have been raised? Secondly, you are citing the two sides of the cyberspace regulations. You say it's good, both good and bad. And you're highlighting government as a perpetrator. How can government be a perpetrator? And if you can cite one or two examples. You're also highlighting or decrying concerns about the latter part of the bill, which is about cyber security. You are decrying a scenario where there could be securitization of the internet. What do you mean that there could be such intention on the part of government to achieve that? Lastly, you say you are from an activist
citizen-driven organization, Right to Know. You should be you should be my natural ally. You and I stand on the same side. Now, what is it that you do which you can recommend in the bill that should not undermine the right of citizens to criticize government without reprieve or without becoming victims of citizens standing up, speaking truth to power without, through all of these platforms, including social media, within the confines, of course, of what is acceptable, which does not border on promotion of violence, or but that space be preserved to allow that citizen exercise that space to speak truth to power. What is it that you can recommend through this framework?
Incitement to anarchy.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, my point of departure will be definition of cybercrime, which is any form of criminal activity, underlying criminal activity, including the use of computers and internet. And then I'll go on to cybersecurity later. In your presentation, you made mention of online activism, isn't it? Yes. I'm sorry, I forgot your name, lady. Online activism. I don't think I personally have any objection to that. But we must take into consideration as long as it then amounts to there is an element of criminality in that, then that's where this bill will then come in, where there is an element of criminal activity. I don't think this bill precludes online activism per se. And then, as Right to Know organization, you might be aware of what happened from the 12th of May this year up to the 15th of May this year in terms of cybersecurity. You are aware of the WannaCry ransomware that attacked, and it affected plus minus 200,000 victims and 300,000 computers were infected worldwide. And therefore, I personally see the relevance then of this legislation to address such things. It's unfortunate, Chairperson, they were unable to present on cybersecurity. I think maybe they were going to touch on that. I hope in your presentation that will come. Hence my saying, this bill then becomes very relevant when taking into consideration the scenario which happened from the 12th, if really you are a Right to Know organization, because you need to know everything. Up to the 15th of May, 2017. Because the bill will then, I assume, protect the users and the public against such. You see? And don't forget that as South Africa, we are a signatory to a lot of international conventions dealing with cybersecurity, even the continental one. AU on cyber crime, you know it better maybe, yes, and the Budapest Convention. Therefore, I think the department and the bill itself is long overdue. You'll recall that this year, even the past year, the president in his SONA, State of the Nation address, made mention of the cybercrime bill. And unfortunately, the department couldn't move. We're moving at a very snail pace. But this is the time. And you know, I'm happy when BASA, Bank Association of South Africa, I hope they are here, are going to present a lot of things. You'll see how important this bill will be. You'll see. But as long as there is that criminal activity involved, the bill is very, very relevant. It's supposed to be here by yesterday. It's unfortunate it couldn't be done. Thank you, Chairperson.
Very important point that an act has got to be unlawful. Nobody would deal with you unless that is unlawful. So address that. Let's hear. Very important, Mamta. Mama Jackie.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'd like to thank you for the presentation. And to actually indicate that we need to actually continue, as Right to Know, to create that balance in our pursuit of knowing that would actually promote constitutional democracy. We talk about something that is like a privacy show or something like that when you're worried about infringement of privacy. But at the same time, you know that there was an email saga. What you actually also alluded to was your thinking about targeted civilians. Now the question is, who should be targeted, who should not be targeted? And one other thing that is important is organizations like yours should actually all the time be heard. There shouldn't be certain things that are going on and then you hear silence on your side. Because with this email saga, what you should have come out with was to indicate as to whether is this constitutionally correct or not. Because then it actually promotes your image, and it actually shows that your kind of interventions are actually balanced. But I hear you when you actually are concerned about the right to privacy. But to what extent, as a country, are we intending observing that right? Will there be citizens in this country that actually manage to realize this right? Will there be citizens that are not in the position to realize the right, and why? That's what you can actually answer for us. Thank you, Chairperson.
Yeah. Sir, I just want to find out, you belong to one liberal organization that perhaps caucus before they came in. Because you seem to be having almost similar things. Yes, I did. Because basically, you see, the problem we're having is that in each and every country, we need to protect our borders. This is why there is strict rules in coming into any country. Now, with this technology, I know I was born before it, with this technology, you are able to just get into any country, do anything. And somehow, one has to try and protect himself as much as possible. This liberal view of, I don't know what you are protecting, who are you protecting? One wonders, I just wanted to find out. You know, when we got democracy in 1994, all of a sudden, lot of NGOs, right to do this. Where were these rights all this time? Who is, that's neither here nor there. But I look at, for example, you're saying fake news and you say you must protect the person can to in other words to gossip. He has got a right to gossip, to distribute fake news. And this is what you said here. And I just don't understand why are you so worried about somebody protecting somebody who is a liar? You know? Why? Because that is harmful. Let's suppose I'm talking about you. And then say, wait, I saw you doing one, two with somebody. And you end up divorcing, your wife divorces you. Or something. You know what I'm trying to say is that it can be very harmful. Now, you say you've got the right to say whatever you want. You've got the right freedom of expression. Freedom. No, I am not happy with it. But however, I promise you, I will do consider your submissions, and I'm not quite happy with your proposal here up to page to say on what you think we should do. I'm not really convinced, however, about that, and I personally feel that the law, the bill, actually stops short of exactly what we want to do. We want to do something further than that. We're trying, by all means. All the countries are being attacked, left and right. I think even America is being attacked. People are attacked from various countries, apart from in within the country. Now, something has to be done. You need to think genuinely and don't only think about your right to know or right to do, and say what can be done to protect the citizens of this country and from this, including from the agents that are inside the country that want to destabilize the country. As Honorable Horn has said, it could be that they want a particular government, which you know, in a particular country. And they use this information to distribute information, choices like this. Even now, you do get a lot of things, the fake emails and things like that. Here and there, you don't know. You've got a right to gossip. It doesn't matter what you say, you've got a right to gossip. We are trying, by all means, to protect our. And you just be responsible for once, and forget about your objective, why you were formed, who is paying you, what they want, and so on. Just for a minute, and forget about it. And say, here is that is important, that is going to bring South Africa forward, that is going to assist every citizen. And just take it to yourself, that if this thing is done to you, or to your company, or to anybody, what effect will it be? Just be objective. Thank you very much.
You know, it's also important to know the history of countries. The governments of this country from the 19th century were built by secret organizations. One aim of the secret organizations was to destroy the indigenous people. And one way of destroying the indigenous people, who are the majority, was to create permissive society. And now the question is, in the work that you do, to what extent are you alive to the fact that there may be people who are still promoting the agenda of creating a permissive society, which is like promoting a national suicide? And when government comes in, and then people hide behind the rights and say, no, our rights are being violated. What about the national interest, the rights of the people? Are you aware? Are you alive of the history of the country, where we come from? Because I've never had an event where secret societies were being dissolved. So I want to assume that they are still at work.
one question and they must answer it as part of the questions. The former deputy president of the ANC, and of the acting president, Khalima Mutanda, is reported to be saying that it would be good if ANC loses power. Should this act be enacted, would that be interpreted as a statement that promotes violence or any unlawful action against the state? I want them to answer that question.
The act is not about a governing party. The act is about society. And that's why this is a public hearing, that we must hear representatives of society what they think about this, because we must come out with something that is in the interest of South Africa and her people, not about any party.
Honorable.
Chairperson, I think there is a tendency that's developing in this committee of actually bringing into play in the business of this committee issues that are misrepresenting the leaders of the ANC. And because this committee is not about the ANC, it's about Parliament, I would actually urge members of other political parties to refrain from mentioning or quoting the leaders of the leadership of the ANC in whatever they want to express, because it's actually becoming a tendency. And even this whole thing about the quotation that has got to do with the previous deputy president, because the danger is them being quoted out of context, and the business of this committee is not about the ANC. So we don't want to enter into a debate about what leaders of the ANC have actually said.
Okay, I just wanted to say, I find, is it only me who find this to be maybe the most ironic statement ever in the light of the fact that we're dealing with the right of freedom of expression in respect of this bill?
The time for this organizer, for the public to talk to us, not for us to be sorting our internal squabble. Can we allow them to deal with other matters?
I think my question has been deliberately distorted.
It's even irrelevant for this city.
No, it's more relevant. Only if she were to understand the context.
Proceed. Thank you, Chairperson, and Honourable.
You have the responsibility to listen to them. We are saying we need a culture of rights and responsibility. And that applies to Honourable members.
Not point scoring.
Thank you, Chairperson. The discussion that I think we're observing right now underpins what the concern is around, particularly the fake news clauses. So if you look, let's point back to how the clause itself is written. It says, the bill criminalizes inherently false in nature and is aimed at causing false news and is aimed at causing mental, psychological, physical, and economic harm. So our first concern is that it criminalizes false information, but then has such broad definition that any information which might be deemed false or harmful, causing mental harm, could be deemed false, and therefore the spirit of discussion, the spirit of debate, gets shut down in democratic society. And respectfully, members, if we were to put some of the comments that have been made here before a body of evidence...
You are missing what Honorable Mutapo said,
yes,
that there must be an element of unlawfulness. Can you address that?
Okay, let me finish my sentence and then I'll come back and address that. But just, I think, to close off on Honourable Horn's concern around but the need to have some kind of legislation, I think the concern of this bill is that, one, it criminalises false news. Two, the way in which the bill itself is framed is that it's too broad, which means that information in a political context could be deemed criminal and therefore shut down dissent, shut down debate and so forth. In terms of then dealing with the pervasiveness of false information in society or what could be seen as false information, even to the extent of influencing an election, as you saw in the American election, there are more substantive ways of dealing with this, and one of them is through civic education, ensuring that citizens are able to, for themselves, identify what is misinformation, for themselves, understand how to scrutinize information. And I think what needs to be done, rather than trying to create new laws, criminal laws, is rather to focus on the civic education element of allowing citizens themselves to be able to engage in information and critically analyze what they're being given, what they're being said. And I think this in itself creates a much more democratic spirit within society, rather than rushing to create a law which could then shut down dissent and democratic discussion. There was a question about what problems the fake news clauses could create. And again, just to say, the problems are inherent to what these kind of clauses could do if they're passed into law. The one is around potentially having a chilling effect in society, and so whistleblowers who might not want to speak out because they're concerned that what they say might be deemed as false information and therefore they'll be criminalized. It could have a detrimental effect on journalism in the country, where journalists might be afraid to then report on things which are drawn out of information sources which aren't sufficiently corroborated at the time, not because they themselves are pushing out false news, but because they're trying to report on false information that's been talked about in the public sphere. And then also it's problematic for, again, citizens, non-citizens, those within our society to engage in robust discussion. It's problematic for our parliament to be able to engage in robust discussion. So the principle here is to say, if we value robust discussion, if we value the ability to have dissenting voices in society, what the bill itself is providing for will not allow that. And so for those reasons, we feel as if it's too broad, it incorrectly criminalizes speech, and therefore it should not be passed into law. I'll allow my colleagues to speak because I need to collect my thoughts about some other questions.
One of the members asked about just giving more detail when we speak about case studies of abuses of government surveillance. The first thing I will say is that it's very difficult to detect these, because one of the reasons we spell this out in our submission is that there isn't sufficient transparency to notify people when they've become targeted for surveillance, even after the fact. Even after investigation has been dropped or charges have been pressed, they never learn that, in fact, they were subject to surveillance, which makes it difficult to document these things. But a few of the case studies which have been sufficiently documented, the one is an investigative reporter who used to be with the Mail and Guardian named Sam Soll, who discovered as part of a court case that, in fact, the security agencies had been monitoring his cell phone communication for up to 6 months, as in listening into the phone calls he was having with sources, with whistleblowers, with colleagues, presumably with his family and friends. All of those calls evidently were being listened to by state intelligence. Another case would be two journalists from the Sunday Times who discovered that as a part of an operation by crime intelligence, their communication was also being monitored around 2010, 2012, during the time that they were reporting on matters related to the police. So these are case studies that have come out in court records, but as the member will know, very many senior members of, in fact, all of the three biggest political parties in Parliament have all made statements to the effect that they suspect their own communications being spied on. Members of unions have made raised similar concerns. So this is about, and I just want to say,
in those case studies,
yeah.
Suppose there's reasonable suspicion that we are working for a terrorist organization that wants to blow up Parliament. Would it be wrong to listen and store information of your communication?
Sure, Chairperson. I think firstly it needs to be stated that all of those case studies, no such suspicion existed, and if it did, it has never been provided. But
What we have stated is that we accept that there are situations where a state must have the power to violate people's privacy, but it must have certain case certain safeguards put in place. One of them must be a higher threshold for a judge to approve it. The second is that the person must be notified of the fact that the communication has been intercepted. Let me give you an example, sir. If you had a reasonable suspicion that I was colluding with a terrorist organization and you're a member of law enforcement, you may intercept my communication. But at some point, you would either have to bring charges to me or drop charges against me or abandon the investigation. There must be an outcome to the investigation. At that point, you compromise nothing by notifying me that my communication has been intercepted. However, in the case studies we have with journalists who've been spied on without having a criminal case brought against them, they were never able to take action to defend themselves, to say either the agency itself has violated my rights or there's a member of that agency who's operating unlawfully within it. He's gone rogue, and he is using those powers.
There must be safeguards on both sides.
And so what we're stating is that those safeguards currently aren't adequately in place, and one of the things that we've asked for from this bill. A similar question was about this issue of securitization of the Internet, and this is where we're coming from in our cyber security part of our submission, is that a top-down approach to security, to cyber security, is not the appropriate response from a government, because for instance, in the case of fake news, or preparing people to respond to fake news, it's the same as preparing people to protect themselves. User education is so important to be able to securing people's systems, so that people know what steps they need to take to secure themselves. That's, you know, so building trust with communities in order to protect themselves. The second is building technology. And creating legal requirements for technology to provide sufficient safeguards for people's privacy. The problem that we have is that the state would like to protect people from other parties, but also be able to intercept their communication. And what we're seeing is that there's an increasing view internationally that if you protect people's privacy, you protect it. It means that their phone can't be hacked, their network is protected, their devices are protected, their technology is secure, and their data is not being stored by any parties without their consent. It means that you can't hack them, but it also means no one else can hack them either. So it's much more of a user-centric approach to cybersecurity and not a top-down, state-centric approach that's driven by the spooks. And my final point, Chairperson, is that the difficulty we have with state security driving this process is that while state security clearly has a role, an advisory role and a supporting role in ensuring that cybersecurity policies are being implemented and being monitored, it is the nature of an intelligence agency to view an environment in terms of threats. And the Internet is so much more than a place of threats. The Internet is meant to be the place where ordinary people can engage in access to information, freedom of expression, and empower ourselves and connect ourselves and build this democracy to make it stronger through a network society. The problem is that when the intelligence agency's first point of reference is to evaluate everyone and everything in that space as a threat, which is why we think that the civilian agencies which are responsible for connecting people should be the people who develop cybersecurity protocols and bring state security in an advisory capacity to support. Thank you, Chair.
Well, thank you very much. I think your inputs are very important. They also highlight the need for broader dialogue, because we may have a situation where elites from Johannesburg, Cape Town, and elites in Parliament are talking to each other above the heads of the people. I think we need to take these discussions to the ordinary people, because all of us claim that we are representing the people, but I'm not sure that the people are with us on some of these things, but you are, for the purpose of this hearing, your input are very important. They are educating us, because we also don't want to make stupid laws. Hello.
You said you prefer go around and educate people about how to protect themselves and what measures they should, rather than the law protects them. Is that what you're saying?
No, sir. I believe that, or I should say we believe that user education is central to the cybersecurity policy. So it mustn't be in the place of law, but it must be the central priority in terms of developing a policy that's put into law, is that it's about empowering users to protect themselves, not about putting state security on top of the internet to watch everyone waiting for one of them to commit a crime.
So the rest for a future debate. Digital law company. Which is replacing IM governance. Digital law company. Thank you very much, Right to Know.
Everybody, thank you so much for the opportunity to come today and address this committee. I am here on behalf of myself and Emma Sadler. We run the digital law company. Emma unfortunately can't be here today, but the submissions have come from both of us. So I should say initially, by way of introduction, my name is Dr. Lizzie Harrison. I am a medical doctor. I am not a lawyer. I work with Emma Sadler, who is a social media lawyer. And between the two of us, we run a business that helps people who have had difficult cases on social media, who are struggling with issues to do with technology. But furthermore, we go out and we educate. So I predominantly focus on the school talks. My background is originally in pediatrics and neuroscience and psychology. So I actually go out and do predominantly the school talks, and Emma focuses now predominantly on the corporate talks and the other organizations. So that is our business, and today we are here specifically to talk actually about Clause 18. So that is the clause regarding revenge pornography, as it's colloquially known. So the way we communicate has changed, obviously, and we are... Oh, sorry, I'm having a problem with my presentation here. Let me just try that again. Oh, I don't appear to be... Sorry, my slide isn't changing there. Sorry? It is technology. Sorry, I think I've lost the connection somewhere. Anyway. So essentially, the way we communicate changed. I may have to do this without the presentation. The way we communicate has changed dramatically. Doesn't take a rocket scientist to tell anybody that. And there are lots of positives to that. And Emma and I, when we go around and educate, we are teaching young people and corporates about how to use social media well. Because there are obviously risks to using social media. And as with anything fun, those risks can be quite severe. So one of the major issues that we see crossing our desk all of the time is revenge pornography, which is actually the distribution of intimate content of a person without their consent. And we are so happy to be able to be here today to be addressing this clause, because this clause is actually incredibly progressive as a worldwide notion. There are very few countries in the world where they have actually legislated against revenge pornography, and we are absolutely fully in support of the legislation. We just propose that certain amendments be made, if possible, to Clause 18 in order to make sure that all of the victims we see, because revenge pornography takes a myriad of forms, we want to ensure that all of the victims we see could seek legal redress under this bill as it currently stands. So there are, as I said, there are a myriad of reasons for revenge pornography. And Emma has really become, to use a fairly unpleasant term, I suppose, but the face of revenge pornography in South Africa. If there's a revenge pornography case, Emma is the spokesperson. Emma is the person who is asked to deal. And actually, we run a pro bono practice. We run a pro bono practice for those people who are victims of revenge pornography because we believe it's such a serious offense. So in terms of talking about the myriad of forms, for instance, you start with an ex-boyfriend, for instance, who decides that now his ex-girlfriend has broken up with him. He's feeling jilted. So he goes and he distributes pictures of her that she has sent him in the context of a consensual relationship. He goes and distributes them now without her permission online. He puts them on porn sites. He sends them to his friends. That is a very common type. We equally see a lot in South Africa where somebody is lured into an online relationship, and I include children in this. They're lured into an online relationship with somebody. They are asked to send pictures of themselves with no clothes on, send pictures of themselves that are provocative, to send videos of themselves performing sexual acts. They are asked to do this by these people who they begin to trust, and they send these pictures. These people then blackmail them with the pictures. They say to them, we'll show your mum what you've been sending, or we will show your family, or we will show your company what we have been what you've been sending if you don't give us this amount of money. And we have had people who have paid up to 200,000 rand to these people in South Africa in order to pay these people off who have got naked pictures of them. So it is a serious offense. It is happening here in South Africa. The other issue is the fact that phones get stolen. iCloud get hacked. And when that happens, what is actually happening in a lot of instances is it's no longer just a case of cancel your contract. It's no longer just a case of call Vodacom and say, my phone's gone, can I get a new device? Because actually what's happening is when the devices are stolen, the content from those devices is being uploaded onto the internet. We had a client, very, very prestigious lawyer in South Africa. She left her phone on the HAL train. The phone was taken. She assumed just taken. She didn't think about it again. Her friend phoned her and said, you need to Google yourself. So she went and she Googled herself. And when she Googled herself, her first result was the law firm she worked for. The second result was her Facebook page. And the 3,300th result were porn sites. She had been sexting her boyfriend overseas, but when they uploaded these things to the porn sites, they put hashtag her name, hashtag the name of the law firm. That is what they did. So actually, this lady, there was nothing we could do. We had to change her name. That was the only way that she could escape this for the rest of her life. Because that is the other problem with social media. Everything you put on social media is permanent. You can't delete the content that you put online, as much as you may want to. You may delete it from your Instagram, from your Snapchat, from your Facebook. You may do that. But first of all, the platform has stored it. Instagram has a copy. Second of all, you have no idea how many people have screenshotted it, taken pictures of it in that time that it did exist online. It's also been backed up to your cloud. It's stored everywhere. So the people who are victims of this offense are suffering for years as a consequence of this. It isn't a once-off emotional problem that they can deal with and move forward. These people are haunted by it. The kids we see who've had this problem, they leave school because naked pictures are going around of them at school. They go to another school. It normally takes about 3 months. The picture surfaces again. They leave that school. They move to another school. So it really is a hugely disruptive problem. So you can't see my slides today, but here I've got a lot of examples that basically we have seen come across our desk. So I'll just read you a couple of excerpts from those. So, I need some advice, please, as I've been blackmailed by someone on Facebook that wants to post my naked pictures on Facebook without my permission. They want cash in return to not post any of these pictures. Can you please assist? Good morning. Yesterday I found out that my ex has created a profile with photographs in my name on a sex chat site. What can I do? I'm 21 years old. I've been in a 15-month relationship. The guy I'm dating cheated on me. I told him it's over, and he sent sexy pictures I sent for to him to my mother. The next one, the same day, he put up a profile of me on Tumblr with naked photos, 16 of them, and then photos of my face, too. I only found out a month later when he decided to add my contact details to the page. A person unknown to me has made a fake profile of me by editing my face onto naked pictures. This one. Our son was involved in an incident which occurred at a school friend's house during the sleepover. The incident occurred sometime last year, but it has only come to our attention in the last month. He's only recently revealed to us what happened. His friend took a video of him while he was in the shower. When he realized this was happening, he tried to cover himself. Once he came out of the shower, he realized that his friend had also videoed the other guests while he was in the shower. He approached this boy, and the boy said, "I will delete the video." My son tells us that he demanded the video was deleted and saw it deleted. Yet, he's gone into school 6 months later to find that a girl from the girls' prep school approached him and notified him that she had seen a video of him naked in the shower. That boy left school. He went to 4 different schools after that. We also have people putting people's contact details online once they've broken up with them or whatever, for sex sites. So some of these people do it just for kicks, as far as we can tell. Some of these people do it to be malicious. The point is, the offense is serious, and we are really happy that the bill is addressing it. We just have a couple, as I said, of things that we would like to see changed in order to make this clause to serve all of our clients, to ensure that we can meet the needs of all of the victims who come in to see us. So the clause as it stands currently, our first concern is that whether this is really the right act in which to address this clause. That's the first concern. That's a big concern. But basically, we feel that this is a sexual offence. We feel that this would be better dealt with under the Sexual Offences Act, simply because the purpose of the Sexual Offences Act is to criminalise any attempt, conspiracy or incitement to commit a sexual offence. It's to provide the South African Police Service with new investigative tools when investigating sexual offences, and it's to provide certain support services to the victims of sexual offences to minimise or, as far as possible, eliminate secondary traumatisation. The proceedings under the Sexual Offences Act, I'm sure you all know, are also required to be held in camera to protect the dignity and reputation of the affected victims. So for us, we feel the Sexual Offences Act would be a better vehicle. Having said that, Emma was here last year talking to the Film and Publications Board about their amendment, because revenge pornography has also been listed in there. And if the choice is between the Film and Publications Board and the Cybercrimes Bill, we are certainly in favour of this bill. We think this bill is a better vehicle than the Film and Publications Book, but we do still propose that it is considered whether or not it should in fact go into the Sexual Offences Act. So, can't see it, but in Clause 18, this clause reads, any person who unlawfully and intentionally makes available. So our first query is with this intentionally makes available. We argue it doesn't actually matter whether the distribution of the content is intentional or not. We also argue that it is incredibly difficult to prove that somebody intended to distribute something. Every single person who has got into trouble for revenge pornography who has crossed our door says to us, it wasn't me, or I must have pressed send accidentally, it wasn't my fault, I didn't mean to. Every single person, and that's what the courts are going to be faced with. They're going to have every single person who walks in there say, I didn't mean to. And it is absolutely impossible in most cases to prove intention. The offence is obviously worse if someone set out to design to cause harm to somebody. Absolutely worse. But we're going to struggle to prove that. Negligence, for instance, with your confidential company material. It wouldn't matter that it was negligent or intentional. The consequences are the same. And we would actually argue that's the same for the victims here. The consequences are the same for them, no matter whether you negligently put that content online or whether you intentionally put that content online. Emma is exposed to a lot of this content because we deal with cases with this. If Emma were to accidentally tweet a naked picture of a client that we'd received, it wouldn't matter that it was accidental. It wouldn't matter that it was accidental. It means she's not, immorally, it's better. But actually the damage to that client is the same. So we just propose that the requirement of intention is removed. The next part of the clause is, any person who unlawfully or intentionally makes available, broadcasts or distributes by means of a computer system. We just propose that the by means of a computer system is removed. We have seen lots of cases where the data message as defined in the bill would be sufficient, but that a computer system would rule out protection for that victim. Because sometimes, for instance, in the boy with the shower case, He's, a video is taken of him while in the shower. Say it was a picture that was taken of him while in the shower. It's then printed and stuck up around the school. We see that often. There's been no distribution by means of a computer system in that at all. But in fact, all that's happened is it's been taken and printed. There's been no distribution by means of a computer system. So we would propose changing that. We then go on to say that when it says that it's got to be a data message of an intimate image, we feel that the definition of pornography under the Criminal Law Amendment Act is broader than that. An intimate image is not the only thing that we believe should be protected. So the definition in the Criminal Law Amendment Act says, pornography means any image, however created, or any description of a person, real or simulated, a description of a person. A lot of the kids, and a lot of adults, in fact, are engaging in what we call text sex, where they are WhatsApping vivid descriptions of sexual acts. No pictures involved, but they're writing things that if they were released into the public are going to be an invasion of their privacy, even though there's no pictures involved. There's no pictures, but we believe it still constitutes revenge pornography. So we would prefer it to be called intimate content as opposed to an intimate image. The next thing that we have an issue with is the fact that it's got to be an intimate image of an identifiable person. You'll be very glad you've not got the slides now, because I've got a lovely picture up. But basically, the next picture is an example of the sort of content we receive. So I'm sure lots of you know about the Margaret Van Veek case. So Margaret Van Veek took pictures of her genitals and intended to send them to her partner. She, in fact, managed to send them to the entire group of hockey mums at school. Now, that is obviously not revenge porn. She's done that to herself. But what happened subsequently was those hockey mums distributed the picture. And that's how it went viral. So that, in our opinion, is revenge pornography. But that's actually not what we're dwelling on. In this situation, Margaret Van Veek is very typical in that she took a picture of her genitals. Her head was not in the picture. There were no identifying features visible. There was no tattoo. There was nothing in that picture that would have told you it was Margaret Van Veek, apart from the scenario, apart from the context. So we feel the person has got to be directly or indirectly identifiable. Because the name is not always stated, the face is not always shown. Also, there are a lot of instances, especially with famous people, we've had it a lot with headmasters of schools, unfortunately, where heads are superimposed onto naked bodies. And they do a good job on Photoshop. And they say, this is the headmaster naked. And that is equally revenge pornography in our mind, even though that body is being incorrectly identified as that of the headmaster. Because that headmaster is suffering infringements on his right to dignity and privacy as a consequence of the publication of that image, even though he is not correctly identified. Our next issue comes with the phrase that says, knowing that the person depicted in the image did not give his or her consent. We think consent is obviously a tricky issue. It's addressed in lots of laws. Our major issue with the consent thing is actually that we don't want victims to have to prove that somebody knew that they did not have consent. That is a huge onus on lawyers and on the victim to prove that the person who distributed it knew that they did not have consent. For us, instead, we propose that the perpetrator has to prove that they knew they had consent for that specific distribution. So it was at the specific time, it was at that same time, it was for that specific event, it was for those specific people. Because you can send a picture to your boyfriend, and you've consented to that, you've sent it to him, but your consent is specific. It does not then say to your boyfriend, you can send this to the entire world. It does not say, you can send this to my boss when we've broken up to humiliate me. It does not say that. But the way the clause is currently phrased could allow people to say, well, she gave consent once. It has to be clear that consent is specific, it's for that particular situation, and it is always voluntary. Next issue is that it says here, for purposes of subsection 1, an intimate image means a visual depiction of a person made by any means under circumstances that give rise to a reasonable expectation of privacy. The only thing that we would change here is we would also add dignity. It is definitely an infringement on privacy, but dignity, we propose, is also a bigger issue, in fact. So in the case that some of you will have heard of with Rob Kardashian and Blac Chyna, his girlfriend. So Blac Chyna has had many pictures of herself taken naked. They are all over the internet. She consented to those. They are all over the internet. So when pictures of her naked were sent out by her boyfriend, Rob Kardashian, people said, well, she's not got an expectation of privacy because actually she's got naked pictures online of her anyway. She's got naked pictures of her online anyway. That's what they said. Actually, we would argue that in that situation it is different because her dignity has been affected by the fact that it's her boyfriend who's distributing those pictures of her. Her ex-boyfriend who's angry with her, who is distributing pictures of her designed to hurt her. That dignity is being affected, not just privacy. And I now know I've got to be quick. My final thing is about the fact that the clause says in which person the person is nude is exposing his or her genital organs or anal region or, in the case of a female, her breasts. Just like the Illinois law, we would propose that we don't make nudity a requirement. There's a very common practice at the moment when a victim is depicted performing oral sex or they've been ejaculated upon, commonly on a face. The picture of the face is taken and distributed. There's no genitals, there's no nudity, but their dignity and their privacy is still infringed. So we have got an ideal clause that we would have put up here, which says that... Do I have time to quickly read it? So it says, any person who makes available, broadcasts or distributes a data message of intimate content of a directly or indirectly identifiable person, whether they be correctly or incorrectly identified, without having obtained specific consent for the making available, broadcasting or distributing of this content in the specific scenario, is guilty of an offense. For purposes of subsection 1, intimate content means any image, however created, or any description of a person or act, real or simulated, made by any means, which a reasonable person would agree is private and or could affect the dignity of the person if distributed. And that's it. Thank you very much.
Work, and you want the elements of a crime changed. The problem is that lawyers say before there is a crime, there must be an unlawful act, there must be intention. Mm-hmm. So, but you know, your illustrations show that there are real problems. Mm-hmm. And thank you for that contribution. Mm-hmm. You are really making a very good contribution. Honorable members,
I just want to say thank you very much for your contribution. We'll look into what you say, except that I'm not sure if it will be accepted constitutionally if you change the intention of the people. You must have an intention.
You have made your point. Maybe this is the revolution that is coming.
and so on. So I, on the clause 18, I do have some reservation on suggestion. However, as I say, I'm not going to deal with them now because one has to seriously look at them. But you talked about why can't this, you actually used the word right law, wrong place or something. What did you say?
And now he said, yeah, I think it was
right idea, wrong act.
that's
what you said.
Yeah.
Which means that it should be in another act. Now, in our system of law, you can pick any law anywhere. So you don't have to file a particular law together with a partner. So I think if it concerns the Sexual Offences Act and is covered by that, I don't think there will be a problem. Even a person adjudicating on the Sexual Offences Act. The discussion actually is provoking her to comment on it, and which will be very helpful in our drafting. So we think that it can be helpful. I don't think it's a big deal the way it is. I don't know. You will come up. I think let me give it.
Thank you, Chair. Firstly, thank you. Maybe an image sent to the Honourable Paul Warren. Yes. No, thank you, Chair. I think much of the presentation has I think opened our eyes to use the words to other possibilities not necessarily covered. I just want to point out that for us to remove the part about a computer program, I think we'll ultimately then broaden this to something. This is the cyber crime bill. So that ultimately I think should be addressed through other avenues. So I would just like comment on that aspect. And then in respect of the intentional, maybe, and while the presenter is not a lawyer, I think we will, as the Honourable Mpulwana has pointed out, struggle with then balancing rights if we are to also include even the negligence and then distributing through a pure oversight and criminalizing that ultimately. Thank you.
Thanks, sir. And thank you for the presentation. It's a beautiful presentation. I think it will get us thinking very deep about the issues that we have raised. I think it does assist us going forward. We also have a whole legal team from the department that is also listening. I think we'll engage, but it is a beautiful presentation that will assist us getting into the legislation. Thank you.
Your company puts people first. Mm-hmm. That's the beauty of it.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for the presentation. You come from the real world. You're actually talking about pertinent issues, which is what the purpose of the bill is all about, to actually help to protect South Africans. Thank you for that. And I think, like Honorable Bongo was saying, this presentation, the representatives of the Department of Justice are listening. We are actually saying to them we're developing a lot of interest in it so that they actually go and look at it. Because I hear lawyers saying, because you're not a lawyer.
I know.
But what you're saying is so valuable. So they must actually go and put the legal language in it. So that it actually manages to work. Thank you, Chairperson.
Okay. No. So there's just a couple of things. So in terms of the Act, I think that Emma and I's main concern was that the Sexual Offences Act is just already equipped to protect the victim at this point. But if it's between this and the Film and Publications, this is the right Act because it is a cybercrime. So that is it isn't a major issue for us. It was just something we wanted to raise as a concern, that we were worried that if it appeared in multiple acts, these perpetrators could escape on the grounds of some wording here or there. And that's what our big concern is, that we want these people to be caught, and we want these people to have to suffer for what they've done, because the consequences to the victims are so severe. In terms of the by means of a computer system, we do understand that that's a problem. We just feel that the data message definition was actually probably okay. But again, not a lawyer, so we'll have to wait and see. But Emma's argument in that situation was that if we remove by means of a computer system but kept the data message aspect, the definition of data message as it is in the Act, we felt was sufficient at that point. But I stand to be corrected on that.
Lawyers have memorized definitions from Roman times. We want young people like you to come with revolutionary things and change society for the better. And thank you very much for your contribution.
Thank you.
Honorable
lunch is here. Let's come back at 22. Are you? Oh, okay.
Sorry, no, Carla does my diary. I'm the worst at this. Carla manages Emma. She can tell the word to you.
The first one was the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Yeah, so we have three presentations.
Three now, yeah. I've got three here.
Still have a lot to do, eh?
Still have a lot to do.
Oh, no, this is day two.
But still, we're not even
hot. I don't want to get No, I'm just saying,
yeah, until like 10 o'clock tonight. If this was like all in one day. Okay, so there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
Do you think to go back? That's possible.
That is true. It's not unheard of. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 15, 17.
Yeah.
I don't think you, Lila, you would be a good candidate.
Yes, absolutely. If you can give me an idea of the content.
There's a panel on Friday.
He doesn't think that this is
going
to run out, and I don't know, he's suggesting that he doesn't find it as serious and it doesn't warrant the team that we suggested. I think this matter may not warrant such an expensive team. We almost had the matter wrapped up with our council, and I'm not sure how expensive the impact will be.
This is
fine.
The picture by internet don't challenge globally.
You know what?
I don't hide the thing here for five examples.
You have all your numbers?
Mm-hmm.
That's
fine.
But
But yours is clearly not really. I mean, they're succeeding to hearing the
sounds like it.
Yeah? That's fine. I'll write it as part of the and then I'll copy Sia.
Sia is obviously going to say no.
And this is Musa in China, the code is one. As I mean,
he's obviously going to say no.
Especially with social media platforms or Facebook.
Why would you almost had a matter of fact about council in the last lecture.
With technology.
Yeah, no, Sia's definitely not going to agree with him. No, Triple C is definitely lying.
You can have. And yes, I will about. You can have any intention to police activities on the internet, but you are not going to be able to keep the pace with the development of technology. Never. I'm not challenging the bill per se. I'm saying we must have a balancing.
There
must be a balancing act of appreciating the fast development of technology against what you want to intend to. Yes. And unfortunately, and with due respect, our intention to legislate will be much slower than the technological development. Unfortunately. Let me give you an example. In the olden days, In the olden days, when there was post newspapers, if you wanted to, there's an emergency at work. If you wanted to censor or impose laws against certain content that is published in those newspapers, what did you do? You send your police to the press and seize all the publications. Today, on electronic media, how do you do that? The answer is you cannot do that. Your police will be all over South Africa looking for content generators and they'll never find them. How about?
Well, he must discuss it with Anton as in today.
Internet solution. Okay, you dimension that. Guys, call. Internet solutions.
Oh.
But I will never lie to you. The development, technological development, also to Mbamba. Mbamba to cut. Kune constitution. Enika also Tamalunga. No corner is appreciated. Yeah, I'll participate in public. Thank you very much.
Whatever.
If you do a senior, you're definitely going to do a junior.
Yeah.
A senior will not run on its own unless you do a, what do you call it, a middle junior, senior, junior, junior, whatever.
But I know I remember Intercell is actually more there than ours. Well, I suppose, because it was a complaint under the international limit, but now it's ours because
it's
the
triple fee.
So, yeah.